Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Now, in terms of the Tupac story, and growing up in the Bay, everyone that I knew was following Tupac from, you know, Digital Underground, same song, you know, he dropped his first album, you know, and people liked him, but a lot of people didn't really see the big picture and the full potential in the beginning. And what a lot of people felt was sort of the turning point in terms of how people viewed Tupac was the situation in Atlanta where he ended up shooting the two white cops.
Basically, an intoxicated off-duty police officer was harassing someone.
A black kid.
A black kid. Pac said something to him. Pac was in the car with the homies, like two cars, and they chose to come to the car and engage, and Pac wasn't the type of dude to back down, and they broke the passenger window, I think. The cop broke the passenger window, and they got shot in the ass.
Now, Edie, you were actually there when it happened. Can you talk about that night and what happened exactly?
I mean, he had a show. It was homecoming. You know, had a show at Clark Atlanta. We was already living in Atlanta, so he was coming through with a few people that was already, you know, on the road and pretty known for traveling with him. And he was like, "Yo, I got a show at Clark, and we're gonna go do the show. Y'all be ready. Nothing out of the normal." And so we went and did the show. Show was a success. We coming back, celebratory mood. Everybody looking forward to the nice festivities. And when we pull up to the hotel, really couldn't see what was going on, but it looked like a fight. And as we got closer, we seen it was two white guys jumping a black dude. You know what I mean? And initially it was just like, y'all get out the way. We trying to park because it was right in front of the entranceway of the hotel we was pulling up into. And it was just about, trying to get them out the way. And then upon further inspection, you see they kicking this dude's ass, really. You know what I'm saying? They working him over. They giving him the business. And immediately, Pac just jumped out the car. And per the usual, whenever he jumped out, everybody was going to jump out. That's just how it went. And so, but we got a caravan. We got a caravan of cars. It's about 7-8 cars coming with us. So everybody's walking up. Pac was in the lead car, so everybody's coming up, to see what the fuck is going on. And by the time we actually get up there, this is when, a gun comes out and is pointing at Pac's sternum.
Okay, so one of the white guys pulls out a gun at Pac. So what, Pac runs in and tries to break it up, or?
I mean, nah, he was running in, basically, I don't know what his mind, his thought process, but I'm assuming, because I know him the way I know him, he wasn't just going to ride past that and just be like, all right, that's on, Hope you figure it out, homie. So, like I said, we was coming up from a long caravan, so couldn't really hear a lot of the dialogue, but, they was going back and forth, and like I said, a gun came out. From one of the white dudes. Now, at the time, we don't know the cops. They're just two white boys beating up a black dude.
Right, because they're off duty.
Right. They were off duty. It's not like they was in uniforms or none of that. Mm-hmm. So, a gun come out, and Pac pulled up his shirt and was like, thug like, motherfucker, shoot. And that just stopped the cop in his tracks. He didn't know what to do at that point. So he was standing next to Pac's car, brand new BMW 750 he had just bought, and he just broke the window with the butt of the gun.
The cop broke Pac's window.
Yeah, with the butt of the gun, and then turned around and started running. And the rest is history.
Well, Pac ended up pulling out his gun.
Exactly.
And shooting at the two white off-duty cops.
Yeah, exactly.
Shot both of them.
Got down on one knee.
Oh, he actually got, because I heard
pop,
he had been
pop, pop, pop.
I'd heard that before that he was going to the gun range a lot and practicing a lot.
Always. You know what I mean? Always. We all went to the gun range, you know what I mean? That's how we relaxed. That's how we passed the time, you know what I mean? And he was definitely a cool shot, a good shot. You know, three shots, bang, 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 two of them hit.
Okay, he shot three times, and I think one of the cops got shot in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
The other one got shot, what, in the leg or something?
I don't remember.
Okay. So, did the white cops shoot at Pac?
No.
No, they just broke. They just broke his glass.
They pulled a gun out on him. One of them did and pointed at him. Yeah. I seen that with my own eyes and, you know, broke the window of the BMW and then turned around and ran.
Okay. Diamond D was there too.
Diamond D was there.
Right. So Pac shot both these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened?
I mean, at the time, we didn't even know the bullets hit because they had got a pretty good run.
Oh, so he shot them from long range.
Yeah, yeah. This was not close range at all. So, you know what I mean? We actually, after it was over, it was like, you know, I wonder if I hit him. You know what I mean? And, you know, a couple of people like, nah, you ain't hit him. You ain't shot like that. Come on, stop it. You ain't get that. You know what I mean? And it was just, you know, the night continued. I remember he had just did Dear Mama. And he was really excited about the potential of that record. It wasn't the version that we all know. It was a little bit.
So this was before Me Against the World came out. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
So he had just did that record, and he was real excited about it. And we just went up and listened to that record, and you know what I mean? Just chilled out, smoked, chilling, whatever, you know, the normal routine after shows.
So you're telling me a group of black guys in the South were not freaked out at this point that Pac had just shot two white guys?
Like I said, we didn't know.
In the South.
We didn't know they was hit.
Oh, okay. But it's still shot at two white guys in the South in a historically racist part of the country.
They initiated it, though. You know, they was beating up a dude. They pulled out a gun first, so,
right.
You know.
But still, how many times have you seen
not many. A
black man do something in self-defense and end up going to prison for life?
I mean, you know, black dudes, they kill each other, man. They ain't out here shooting at no white boys. You know what I mean?
Okay. So you guys went back to the studio. All good.
The hotel.
Chilled, laughed it off, essentially. And then the news comes out that these two were cops.
Mm.
How did Pac take it when he found that out?
I don't really know because towards the end of the night, we left and went back to the house in Georgia and he stayed at the hotel. And, you know, we got the word that the cops was at the hotel and he was arrested.
Oh, so they picked him up the same night?
Nah, later that, the next day.
The next day.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next day he got picked up, charged, and then they find out that they were cops.
Right.
How did he feel at that point?
I'm really not sure, man, because he was locked up. You know what I'm saying? And I think once he got bail, he had to go to New York. He was on trial in New York. And, you know, everything, you know, that was a hectic month because that's also the month where he was robbed and shot at Quad as well. You know what I'm saying? I think that happened like a month later. So shortly after he made bail and got out of jail, you know, Pac pretty much went back to New York to continue to do what he was doing. I don't know if he was working on a movie or, you know, he was working. So I don't really know how he felt, but I know, you know.
That's a crazy situation, man. What the fuck, you know?
Stressed out.
That situation could have took him to a whole different place if it went a different route.
Okay.
But at the time, you gotta remember, he was fighting like 12 to 13 cases at that time.
Right.
So at that point, it was just like another one. It was just like,
terrible.
You know, here go another one.
I remember me and Be Legit, we did a talk at UC Berkeley about Tupac, because I had just dropped a Tupac mixtape, and he was, you know, Be Legit was friends with Tupac. And he was telling me how during that time, Pac was wearing silver jewelry and telling people it was platinum because he was so broke from all the lawyer's fees, from trying to fight all these cases that he literally couldn't afford. You know, he was wearing fake jewelry. I mean, not fake, but silver jewelry because it was like...
I don't really remember that, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Be Legit, that's the homie. You know what I mean? I love that. But I don't never wear... I don't remember Pac ever having silver jewelry on post his record deal.
Okay. You know what I mean? He was spending a lot of money on lawyers.
He was definitely spending a whole shitload of money on lawyers. But remember, he got robbed, you know, and shot for his gold diamond encrusted cross and the Rolex, and you know what I mean?
So okay.
He still had his pieces, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So he gets charged with the shooting of these two officers. But then it never actually makes it to court, right?
Right.
Because it was proven that they were drinking.
It was proven that they was drinking, that the gun that they had pulled out was from another case they had got out of an evidence.
Right.
So
it was a stolen gun, essentially.
Yeah.
He got lucky to shoot the crooked cops.
They was basically, you know, some dirty dudes.
Yeah.
And at that point, and I remember reading a lot of articles, I think maybe even Jada Pinkett was talking about this, of how for a black man to shoot two white cops in the South and to walk away from it, like, the effects in the black community were immense from that. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, after that definitely put him on legendary status, you know what I mean? Living legend after that, you know. It was a lot of different incidences that were kind of smaller, but on the same level, that never really got, you know, publicized. So, you know, he was already a superhero to us, you know what I mean? Even being our brother, you know what I'm saying? I was pretty impressive to have the wherewithal to do that, because to be honest with you, it was some cats around, you know, street certified cats around Pac and you know, carrying guns and all of that froze that day. You know what I mean? Pac literally was the only dude that reacted.
Oh, so there's other people with guns who just didn't do nothing.
It was, I put it to you like this, it was other dudes around that you would expect to be the ones
who was probably there for it to hold him down.
You know what I mean? And Pac was the one that reacted first.
Wow.
It could have went another way, man. You know what I mean? That shit.
Yeah, it could have another. They could have shot. Yeah. They could have shot when he pulled up his shirt and said, you know, thug life and all that.
Or they could have been not dirty cops and he could have got sent away for, you know, the rest of half his damn life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, easy.
He got lucky, man.
Oh, easy. In Georgia? Forget
lucky.
About it.
Super lucky.
Yeah. You know, they were still, you know, had the Confederate flag up at the time and the whole nine.
Cops had it out for him after that, too, man.
Oh, so you think after that, that's when sort of the animosity between the police and Tupac really elevated?
No, you gotta understand, he come from a Black Panther foundation, so, you know, just his last name alone is like, you know, come from wanted posters and
his
shit
mother
like that.
Defeated,
you know,
the
I mean?
New York judicial system
right.
By herself, so he was kind of already on the radar.
Yeah.
Long before
that kind of shit,
in
though.
Atlanta.
With celebrity and beating that, it got hectic after that.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 1, 2021. So I have been told, Gus T., just thankful that we survived the heat dome temperature assault here in Seattle, Washington, and throughout the Pacific Northwest region. We had temperatures approaching 110 degrees on Monday. We had three consecutive days of 100 degree weather, all of which is, you know, absurd for this part of the world. So just thankful we're back to normal weather and did not melt away. We are back with our book club in the cool weather. This is our fourth session on Randall Sullivan, who is a white man. His book, Labyrinth, A Detective Investigates the Murders of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G., The Implication of Death Row Records, Suge Knight, and the Origins of the Los Angeles Police Scandal. Full title, it is a lengthy one. So the segment that we heard at the beginning, that was from DJ Vlad. Folks who are into the hip-hop world, so-called, probably have seen some of his content on YouTube. He did an interview with the Outlaws. These are black males, entertainers, who performed with Mr. Shakur on a number of different songs over the years before his murder. So DJ Vlad is interviewing the Outlaw members, victims of racism, about the Atlanta shooting. At least one of the victims saying that he was present for this shooting when everything happened that night, October 1993. Now, this is important We discussed this incident last week in Sullivan's writing. He describes these white officers as drunken yahoos, okay, in terms of the, why this happened and why this case was thrown off the charges against Mr. Shakur. Now, the outlaws, now they're doing this via their memory. This we're talking about something that happened nearly 30 years ago. So, you know, maybe their memory is pristine, maybe not. But they said that these white officers, yahoos, did not fire any shots, that Tupac returned fire after they broke the window of the vehicle with the butt of the gun, and then Pac fired his shots and hit the officers. Now, John Patash, in his book that has a lot of footnotes, he is a white man, so his book could be an error as well. Footnote 343 has a lot of footnotes. He writes, "The Daily Atlanta Journal-Constitution gave exact quotes of the police report in which Edward Fields is quoted as saying that one of the white males pull out and point a black handgun, started yelling, 'Get down, get down,' and then fired one shot towards the Mercedes. Kathy Scruggs and Scott Marshall, witness says off-duty cops fired first shot, claims rappers return fire caused brothers wounds. Atlanta Journal-Constitution, November 3rd, 1993, page D12. Ellis said that the prosecutor spent a long cross-examination to get Fields to say that the officer's shots could have been warning shot, and the newspaper then reported it that way," in the footnote 343. Now, I'm just including that because you heard from the outlaws. They said that the officers did not fire a shot. I'm saying that that is disputed. And since we're reading a book that doesn't have any footnotes, thought that was important. All of that, neither here nor there, just to add additional context as we try to process this. Again, I thought, you know, hey, if we're reading a book that's supposed to be about police corruption, LAPD corruption at minimum, and then you've got other incidents of enforcement officials engaging in corrupt and criminal behavior and participating in what, as John Patash labels it, participating in a failed assassination attempt. At least if you're firing a gun at someone in my attempt, and according to logic, you are intending to kill that person if you're shooting at them, even threatening them with a firearm. So, again, I think you could make a lot of connections. Sullivan doesn't seem to do that. Really loose with the information and footnotes, or not providing footnotes and references for his material. But we will continue picking up in part three of Labyrinth, Randall Sullivan, Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment one.
Part three, Natural Leads. Detective Poole is a self-motivator who is enthusiastic and consistently gets the job done. He has the quality of knowing what has to be done and does the job without being told. Detective Poole plans and organizes his caseload in a most efficient manner. From the performance evaluation report filed on Detective Russell Poole for the period 10/1/94 to 3/18/95. Chapter 6. For Russell Poole, his assignment to find the shooter in the Biggie Smalls slaying was an opportunity to escape the stricture of the Gaines-Liga case. A murder investigation, Poole believed, would not be subject to the sort of bureaucratic intrigue that had frustrated his attempt to probe the links between the LAPD and Death Row Records. "I guess you could say ignorance was bliss," Poole recalled, at least at the beginning. By the time Poole joined them, homicide detectives from the LAPD's Wilshire Division had spent nearly 1 month building a case that appeared to be headed nowhere in particular. Not that the Wilshire detectives hadn't kept busy. The murder book on the Smalls investigation already was thick with witness interviews, clue notes, and evidence analysis. The curious quality of it all, though, was that the picture that emerged could be at once so detailed and so sketchy. Most of what the LAPD knew about Biggie's murder came from the 10 young men who had been riding with him in the caravan of three vehicles that had just left the Vibe magazine party at the Peterson Automotive Museum. Puffy Combs, who had been sitting in the passenger seat of the Suburban just ahead of Biggie's, understood that coming to Los Angeles for that year's Soul Train Awards entailed a certain amount of risk. But Paul Offord, Bad Boy Entertainment's director of security, who had been riding in the trail car right behind Biggie's Suburban, explained to detectives that with Suge Knight in jail, there was a general feeling that the East versus West feud was cooling off. Prior to the shooting, Biggie and Puffy had spent almost a month in Los Angeles without incident. They were in town to promote Biggie's upcoming album, Puffy had explained to the Wilshire detectives, and to take advantage of LA's superior production facilities to shoot and edit several videos that would be released with the album. Also, Biggie saw the trip as a chance to tell California radio listeners that he loved their state and wanted no trouble with anyone out here. At the Soul Train Awards on the evening of Friday, March 7, 1997, Biggie, who had been injured in an auto accident a month earlier, walked on stage to present an award with the aid of the cane he needed to help support his 6'3", 390-pound body. Before he could announce that the winner was R&B singer Toni Braxton, however, Biggie's voice was drowned out by boos from a contingent of Bloods who sat in the balcony throwing West Coast signs at him. "What's up, Cali?" Biggie yelled back, his tone light, yet defiant. The big rapper left the event almost immediately, however, and watched the rest of it on the television set in his suite in the Westwood Marquee. Puffy remained in his seat until the end of the award ceremony, but when he tried to leave the auditorium by a stage door, Combs had been confronted by a Nation of Islam member in a suit and bow tie who accused him of disrespecting our brothers in the East. He and Puffy had both tensed up, Eugene Deal would recall, but then Combs had spotted Louis Farrakhan's son, Mustafa, nearby and called out, "Yo, Mustafa, tell him you and I are cool." When Mustafa Farrakhan nodded, his lieutenant had stepped aside and let Puffy pass without further incident. Biggie and Puffy did not decide until the next afternoon that they would attend the Vibe after party on Saturday evening. The party was to be a closed event for music industry executives only, Puffy had been told, so security would not be a problem. The Bad Boy group assembled at the Hollywood Hills home of Andre Harrell, who now was CEO of Motown Records. Puffy had been staying with his former boss for the past week. He and Biggie and their entourage traveled to the Peterson Museum in three separate vehicles. In front was the white Suburban in which Combs rode with his man Kenneth Story at the wheel and three bodyguards in the back seat. Next came the gangbanger green Suburban in which Biggie sat up front with his driver Gregory G. Money Young, while junior mafia rapper James Lloyd, Lil Caesar, who had grown up with Biggie in Brooklyn, and Biggie's best friend Damian, D-Rock Butler, sat in the back seat. The trail car was a black Chevy Blazer in which Bad Boy handyman Lewis, Groovy Love Jones, rode with Offord and an off-duty police officer who was working security for Biggie that night. The scene at the Peterson Museum had been surprisingly mellow, everyone agreed, especially given the complications suggested by the guest list. Among the women in attendance, for example, were Biggie's estranged wife, Faith Evans, Tupac Shakur's former fiancée, Kidada Jones, and Suge Knight's estranged wife, Sharitha. DJ Quick had shown up with 10 treetop Pyrus in tow, while the dozen or so Crips who wangled invitations included Orlando Anderson. Upon arrival, Biggie headed straight for a table in a dark corner, where he remained seated for the entire evening. When the DJ played Biggie's new rap homage to the West Coast, going back to Cali, the crowd erupted in cheers, and there was a general feeling that with Suge Knight removed from the scene, peace might be at hand. By midnight, however, the museum was crammed with many more people than it was permitted to contain, and an overwhelming majority were smoking marijuana. At 12:30 a.m., the air was so thick with smoke that an announcer was sent to the microphone to tell the crowd, "Please stop smoking blunts. The fire marshal's gonna turn the party out." Biggie, Puffy, and the rest of the Bad Boy contingent headed immediately for the nearest exit, as did many other partygoers who believed they had heard the announcer say the fire department was shutting the party down. Gulping the cool, fresh air outside, Biggie and Puffy waited for valets to deliver their vehicles to the curb of the museum's parking structure, debating whether to hit another party or head back to the Westwood Marquee. Puffy decided they should just go back to the hotel, then climbed into the white Suburban next to Kenneth Story, with his three bodyguards in the back of the vehicle. Biggie lifted himself into the passenger seat of the green Suburban next to G-Money, with Lil Caesar and D-Rock in the next row of seats. Just as the vehicle pulled away from the curb, Groovy Love slid into the third row of seats. Paul Offord again rode with the off-duty police officer in the black Chevy Blazer. Biggie's Suburban bore a sticker on one wheel that read, Think B.I.G. It was a promotion for his new double album, Life After Death, which was playing at deafening volume on the green Suburban sound system as the vehicle turned left out of the parking structure and headed north on Fairfax Avenue. Puffy's Suburban, still in the lead, blew through the amber light at Wilshire Boulevard and was preparing to make a left turn as the light turned red and stopped Biggie's vehicle on the south side of the intersection. A white Toyota Land Cruiser promptly made a U-turn on Fairfax and tried to cut between the green Suburban and the black Blazer that was approaching from the rear. At that moment, a dark-colored sedan pulled up on the green Suburban's right side. The driver, a black male with a fade haircut who wore either a light gray or pale blue suit and a bow tie, looked Biggie in the eye for a moment, then reached across his body with a chrome-plated automatic pistol held in his right hand, braced it against his left forearm, and emptied the gun into the front passenger seat of the Suburban. Clearly the target of the attack, Biggie Smalls had been the only passenger in the green Suburban who was hit by the bullets, which riddled his immense torso. The dark sedan then sped away eastbound on Wilshire, made a left turn on Ogden Drive, and disappeared into the night. The white Land Cruiser made another U-turn and sped away also. The Suburban, in which Puffy Combs rode, slowed nearly to a stop when the driver heard gunshots. Everyone inside ducked their heads, then someone shouted that Biggie was under attack. Combs jumped out of the vehicle a few moments later and ran across Wilshire to the green Suburban. When he opened the passenger side door, Puffy saw Biggie hunched over the dashboard with his tongue hanging out of his mouth, bleeding through his jacket. When he spoke to Biggie, Puffy told police, his friend just stared back, eyes wide open and scarily blank. The terrified Combs jumped into the Suburban behind Biggie as Kenneth Story pushed G-Money aside and drove the vehicle to the emergency dock of the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, less than 5 minutes away. At the hospital, it took six people to lift Biggie onto a gurney. Doctors rushed him into surgery as Combs, Lloyd, Butler, and the others dropped to their knees and prayed. But Biggie was pronounced dead at 1:15 a.m. Gregory Young and James Lloyd were the only two passengers in the green Suburban who said they had gotten a good look at the killer's face, and at the hospital that night, they assisted police in making a composite drawing of the suspect. Both Young and Lloyd had described the assassin's vehicle as a dark green sedan, but police realized that the four vapor lights that illuminated the shooting scene could have given a greenish cast to a black car if it was clean and shiny. Kenneth Story told police that three separate witnesses had approached him at the hospital to say that the killer had been driving a clean black Chevrolet Impala Supersport. He had seen exactly such a vehicle parked on Fairfax Avenue as he and the rest of the bad boy group waited for their vehicles in the Peterson Museum's parking structure, Story said. A Metropolitan Transit Authority driver whose bus had been westbound on Wilshire when the shooting occurred confirmed to police that the shooter's sedan was black and said he had watched a white SUV speed from the scene after the sedan and make the same left turn on Ogden Drive that it did. Kenneth Story also gave police four shell casings that had been given to him by two separate witnesses who said they were collected from the shooting scene. LAPD officers already had collected three other matching shell casings, all of them from German-made Gecko brand bullets that were rarely seen on the West Coast. The biggest obstacle the police faced in investigating the murder of Biggie Smalls was that almost no one who had been present at the scene wanted to talk to the cops. As the first LAPD progress report filed on the case would note, despite the hundreds of people who attended the party, detectives have located few admitted witnesses to the shooting. Part of the problem was that Suge Knight had been identified as a suspect in the first story that appeared in the Los Angeles Times on the morning of March 9th. Knight's brother-in-law, Norris Anderson, who had taken over as general manager of Death Row while Suge was away, told the Times, "It's ludicrous for anyone out there to blame Death Row. We do not condone this type of activity, and Death Row certainly had nothing to do with it. Death Row knows how bad something like this can feel. It happened in our backyard with Tupac just a few months ago." Most observers felt that Anderson's last point was the important one. Revenge for Tupac's killing would be the main motive offered by both police and media to explain Biggie's assassination during the next few days. The rumor that Suge Knight was responsible for Biggie's death spread through the worlds of both hip-hop musicians and black gangbangers all during that day, followed soon by a story that Suge had been attacked in prison by an inmate who stabbed him 11 times with a chicken bone. Death Row replied the next afternoon with a prepared statement. Death Row Records would like to dispel all rumors and speculations of a prison stabbing incident involving Marion Knight, CEO, Death Row Records. Mr. Knight has not been part of any type of attack and is doing fine. That same day, however, an LAPD lieutenant was quoted in the Times as saying that police believed Biggie Smalls' death had been a hit, a directed target coming out of New York, Los Angeles, or Atlanta. The head of the New York Police Department's anti-gang enforcement section was even more explicit. All indications are that Biggie Smalls' murder was retaliation for Tupac Shakur's murder. The first question Russell Poole asked was why the LAPD's Major Crimes Unit hadn't taken over the Smalls murder investigation until 4 weeks after Biggie's death. I couldn't recall a single other murder case with that kind of high profile where Major Crimes wasn't called in right from the start, Poole explained. The brass gave an explanation that they needed the resources for the Ennis Cosby case, but that was bullshit. We had another 15 or 16 detectives available. Somebody high up in the department didn't want Major Crimes involved. They only asked us to take over when Wilshire Homicide said they couldn't handle such a complicated investigation. This was a month after the murder, and I think by that time they had realized they better move control of the investigation downtown. Poole was even more troubled when he looked at the logs of the first 24 hours after Biggie's murder and discovered that four robbery-homicide detectives and an RHD lieutenant had been at the hospital and the murder scene during the early morning hours of March 9th. I never could get an explanation of why they didn't take the case right then, Poole recalled. It was perplexing, to say the least. The case clearly had overwhelmed the Wilshire detectives. During my investigation of Kevin Gaines, I was constantly over there trying to probe around, Poole recalled. But they were going in circles. They'd start on one thing, go with it for a while, then jump on another clue that came along and drop the first thing. That's how confused they were. These were good detectives, but they didn't have experience in handling a high-profile case, and they still had to handle their normal workload of murders in Wilshire. Poole believed the phone call that Wilshire Detective Paul Inabu had made to him on April 1st, asking for a photograph of Kevin Gaines, was what caused the transfer of the case to robbery-homicide. Word got around quickly, he recalled. The lieutenant went to the captain went to the commander, and the commander went to Deputy Chief Parks. Immediately, Fred Miller was called to a meeting with the lieutenant, but no one spoke to me. Your partner is supposed to keep you informed, but all Fred would tell me was that we had been offered the case, and he was in charge. When Poole asked if detectives had followed up on the report that Kevin Gaines had been involved in drug deals and gun sales involving Suge Knight and Death Row Records, he was told to leave it alone. My superiors made it clear they didn't want to probe that clue, Poole recalled. They didn't want cops going around with that photograph showing it to people. Poole decided not to make waves. I understood that the brass had political considerations. My approach was to keep my mouth shut and my eyes open, to be the same detective I'd always been, but keep quiet about it. What most rankled Poole was his exclusion from Miller's meetings with their lieutenant and captain. They already understood that I was an aggressive investigator, and they were concerned about keeping me contained, Poole said. The best way to do that was to withhold information. But in my entire career, I'd never been part of any investigation where I was expected to work in the dark. At least he and Miller agreed on one point, Poole recalled. The Wilshire detectives had wasted a lot of time and energy chasing the theory that the Crips killed Biggie Smalls. The story had been started by a pair of anonymous tipsters who phoned Wilshire Division and told detectives there that Biggie had been killed because he owed the Southside Compton Crips money for security work, and that Keefe D was the shooter. Keefe D's real name was Dwayne Keith Davis, and he was the uncle of Orlando Anderson. When this story leaked out, Puffy Combs denied ever employing gangbangers at Bad Boy Entertainment. We've never hired Crips or any other gang members to do security for us, he told MTV's Kurt Loder. But the misconception is that because we're young and black, we're not handling business like anybody else. Dozens of witnesses recalled that Puffy and Biggie had been accompanied by Crips at the 1996 Soul Train Awards show, however, and a number of intriguing clues linking the Crips to Biggie Smalls surfaced almost immediately. Compton Police Department Detective Tim Brennan told the LAPD that the Southside Crips had definitely provided security for Notorious B.I.G. in the past, and that Biggie had attended a celebrity basketball game at Cal State Dominguez Hills, right next to Compton, the day before the murder. An anonymous informant added that Biggie was at the Crips' main hangout in Compton, Southside Park, that same day with members of his entourage. Yet another anonymous informant, this one offering a more detailed story than any of the others, said the East versus West feud had turned deadly during the summer of 1996 when Puffy Combs placed a contract on Suge Knight and offered a reward to anyone who could bring him a death row medallion. This was why Tupac Shakur got shot, the caller said. This informant also said the killer of Biggie Smalls was not Keefe D, but one Ozine Bridgeford. What made this interesting was that, according to the Compton cops, Bridgeford was a former mob Piru Blood who had left the gang when he had a falling out with Suge Knight's scariest thug, Alton Buntry McDonald. Bridgeford had become so convinced Buntry was going to kill him that he went over to the Crips. It was soon after this, according to the informant, that he accepted the contract on Biggie. The story made no sense to anyone who understood the way Compton's gangs operated. The Bloods were the ones who wanted Tupac Shakur's murder avenged and who had been threatening Biggie Smalls for the past 3 years. Why would someone who had abandoned that gang to join the Crips take a contract on Biggie? The Los Angeles Times jumped aboard the Crips theory, however, and was writing it into the ground. The Times also was reporting that the killer hadn't fired from inside that dark sedan either, but rather walked up to Biggie's Suburban and struck up a friendly conversation. Biggie was rolling down his window to give him five, according to the Times report, when the man pulled a gun and opened fire. The LAPD could have blown this nonsense out of the water quite easily, but all the department's spokesman, Lieutenant Ross Moen, would offer in response was, "There are a lot of people saying different things." The theory that the Crips were behind Biggie's death was given a further infusion of life when LAPD detectives learned that Keefe D had been issued two traffic citations in 1996 while driving a new black Impala Supersport. The LAPD Support Division did a flyover of Keefe D's home on California Avenue in Compton and spotted a partially covered black vehicle behind the residence. When the police seized Keefe D's Supersport, the Crip hired attorney Eddie M.O. Fall, who earlier had represented Orlando Anderson, to tell reporters, "Mr. Davis intends to make it absolutely clear that he had nothing to do with the death of Notorious B.I.G." But by then, the news had leaked out that Keefe D was at the Peterson Museum party on the night Biggie Smalls had been killed. On March 20th, in an interview at One Police Plaza in New York, James Lloyd told the police that Keefe D approached him at the party with 10 other Crips and said, "What's up? You need some security? Someone by your side?" When Lloyd told him, "We're all right," Keefe D walked over to Biggie and spoke briefly to him, Lloyd said. "There was no hostility, though," Little Caesar added. When security hurried over to head off trouble, Biggie waved them off, saying, "He's cool, I know him." And both Lloyd and Greg Young agreed that the shooter had not been Keefe D or any of the other Crips whose photographs they were asked to view. Finally, after Keefe D proved he had an ironclad alibi, Fred Miller told the Times, "We haven't named him as a suspect. We don't think he had anything to do with it." Russell Poole had considered the Crips theory dubious from the outset. "To me, it was obvious this wasn't a gang shooting. Biggie's murder was much more sophisticated than anything I've ever seen any gangbanger pull off. This was professionally executed. We all knew that. It was obvious. Also, the fact that a reward of $25,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of Biggie's killer had been offered by the city of Los Angeles mitigated overwhelmingly against the theory that the Crips had been behind the murder. In my experience, a reward offer of $2,500 would have solved any crime that was committed by a Crip," Poole said. "Somebody would have snitched, I can guarantee you. And for $25,000, you would have had people lining up to collect the money. There was a big announcement in the media, and posters were distributed all over Compton and South Central. Yet no one came forward, not even when Biggie's mother doubled the reward to $50,000 3 weeks later. I was convinced pretty quickly that the implication of the Crips was a smokescreen, The only question was, who had been blowing the smoke? On April 14th, Poole became the first LAPD officer to speak at length with Biggie Smalls' mother, Valletta Wallace. The woman was blunt in stating her belief that, as she put it to the Los Angeles Times, the police don't care about solving the murders of young black men. She was especially skeptical about a white detective who sounded to her like a character out of a cowboy movie, Wallace admitted. Russell Poole, however, was a police officer who had been praised again and again for an unusual ability to win the confidence of people who had lost loved ones to gang violence. Empathetic was an adjective that appeared repeatedly in his personnel package. In dealing with the friends and family members of homicide victims, Detective Poole is compassionate, sympathetic, and most of all, never too busy to make himself available to discuss the status of the case. His supervisor at South Bureau Homicide had written in 1995, "He consistently leaves them with the confidence that he sincerely cares." That was true, agreed Valletta Wallace, who eventually would describe Poole as the single officer of the Los Angeles Police Department whom she felt could be trusted. For her, the reason was quite simple. Detective Poole wanted to know who my son was. None of the others ever asked. For most of her adult life, Valletta Wallace had worked two jobs to raise her only child in the third-floor walk-up apartment on St. James Street in Brooklyn's Clinton Hill neighborhood. Though a young girl when she moved to New York City from Trelawney, Jamaica in 1959, Valletta still spoke in the lilting accent of her native island. Biggie's father was Jamaican also, a small-time politician and businessman named George Latour, who abandoned the family before his son was 2 years old. Biggie saw Latour once more at the age of six, but grew up without any memory of the man. Christopher Wallace was the largest five-year-old in his neighborhood, and at the age of 10, already was known by the other children as Big. Valletta, who worked days as a preschool teacher, enrolled her son at St. Peter's Claver Elementary and Queen of All Saints Middle School, where he was on the honor roll and won awards as the best English and math student in his class. Biggie also began well at one of Brooklyn's best public high schools, Westinghouse, but rapidly lost interest in all his classes except art and, to his mother's immense displeasure, dropped out during his junior year at age 17. He could make money on the streets, Biggie knew, as a dope peddler. Soon he was venturing east up Fulton Street into Bedford-Stuyvesant, selling weed and nickel bags of crack cocaine on street corners. He talked a lot tougher than he was, according to the officers of the 88th Precinct, who remembered Wallace as a soft, scared kid who would cry whenever they brought him in for questioning. When Biggie was busted for selling crack during a visit to North Carolina in 1991, he phoned his mother in tears, pleading with her to send the $25,000 he needed to make bail. Soon after his return to Brooklyn, Biggie went back to selling $3 vials of crack in front of a Chinese restaurant on Flatbush Avenue, but he also began spending a lot more time at the home of a childhood friend named Chico Del Vico. In a small back room, the two used a pair of Technics turntables to begin mixing the sounds that Biggie gradually flavored with lyrics about life on the street in Clinton Hill. Almost everyone who heard the pair remarked that Biggie seemed to have a natural gift. His mother believed it was hereditary. Rap has roots in what Jamaicans called toasting, a musical form that originated with island disc jockeys like Duke Reed and Prince Buster, who spoke aloud over the American R&B records they played at blues dances in Kingston's ghettos. Early on, the DJs shouted simple phrases like work it and move it up that evolved into longer and longer toasts. Eventually, toasting stars like U-Roy began to create lengthy sing-song rhymes backed by steel drums and a heavy bass line. Bronx DJ Kool Herc, who had been born in Kingston under the name Clive Campbell, was heavily influenced by Jamaica's toasting tradition when he began to pioneer the music form that became known in America as rap during the early 1970s. Almost 20 years later, Christopher Wallace and Chico Del Vico formed a DJ group they called 50 Grand, and began working street corners and small clubs with a crew from Bedford Avenue that called itself the Old Gold Brothers. Eventually, Biggie began to perform solo as Quest and produced a crude set of homemade demo tapes. Eventually, one of those tapes made it into the hands of the Brooklyn rapper Mr. C, who passed it along to the new national director of A&R at Uptown Records, Puffy Combs. Puffy was transfixed. "As soon as I put it on, it just bugged me out," he later told MTV. I listened for days and days, hours and hours, and his voice just hypnotized me. Biggie's voice was unique in rap, husky and harsh, yet melodic and musical in a way that made speech sound almost like singing. And Puffy, like a lot of people who heard those early tapes, loved Biggie's lyrics. His mother thought Christopher had developed his ear by listening to the nursery rhymes she read to him every night as a preschooler. His tales of small-time gangsters, street scuffles, sexual intrigues, and bloody climaxes were, to Combs's ear, the first really authentic gangster rap produced on the East Coast. The success in the late 80s of N.W.A.'s Straight Outta Compton and the rapid rise of Death Row Records had transformed rap almost overnight. East Coast groups like Def Jam's LL Cool J and Public Enemy were eclipsed by what Dr. Dre, Ice-T, and Snoop Dogg were doing on the West Coast, but Biggie played Bad better than anybody who had come before him. He would never have Tupac Shakur's sex appeal, but Biggie's look was unlike anyone else's. A hulking fat boy whose favorite meal was waffles with ice cream and bacon, Biggie's wide, round, pouchy eyes and pudgy, hairless face gave him the look of an immense child, while his deadpan scowl and wandering left eye suggested just enough menace to make him interesting. Even as a drug dealer, he'd paid attention to his wardrobe. Working the streets in a fashionable ensemble of Timberland boots, Carl Kani jeans, and hockey jerseys, topped by a terry cloth headband. When he became Biggie Smalls, a name borrowed from a character in the Sidney Poitier Bill Cosby film Uptown Saturday Night, the combination of his dark skin and pale pink lips with the pinstriped suits and derby hats he wore suggested a fellow who'd been recruited off the Chitlin' circuit into Al Capone's mob. "I may be a big black ugly dude," he once told an interviewer, "but I got style." Style for gangster rappers was the product of an outlandish cross-cultural fertilization that combined ghetto gangbanger attitudes and Rastaman spirituality with the patois of Hollywood mafiosi, and Biggie had a natural affinity for all the form's origins. Puffy Combs told the 19-year-old he was poised to become a major star, but then one night in 1993, Biggie learned that his mentor was out of a job. Puffy immediately began organizing a plan to launch his own record label, one that would be built around Biggie Smalls. Puffy's greatest challenge was making Biggie believe it could still happen. Despondent over Puffy's ouster from Uptown Records, Biggie had a pregnant girlfriend, a best friend, Damian Butler, who was behind bars, and a mother who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. Drunk most of every day on the Hennessy cognac he imbibed, Biggie was tempted to return to the streets with his vials of crack, but Puffy hustled to distract him with small jobs performing on remixes with other rappers. Finally, after working on it in the studio for months, Puffy was ready to release Biggie's first solo album under a title that was even more sadly ironic than his posthumous Life After Death. Ready to Die, Biggie's debut on the Bad Boy label, produced two singles that hit number one on Billboard's chart, Big Papa and One More Chance. Both went double platinum, and One More Chance was named Billboard's Rap Single of the Year. Biggie, who was not quite 21, had become rich and famous overnight. Performing now as Notorious B.I.G., because another rapper out in California had called himself Biggie Smalls first. He was voted Billboard's best rap artist in 1995. By then, though, the lethal idiocies of life as a gangster rapper already were beginning to threaten not only his success, but his very existence. For a lot of it, Biggie had only himself to blame. Biggie and his entourage were arrested for the 1994 beating of a music promoter named Nathaniel Banks in Camden, New Jersey, a charge that put the rapper in jail for 4 days. Then in March of 1995, Biggie and a friend became annoyed by autograph seekers as they were leaving the Palladium near Manhattan's Union Square and exchanged shouted threats with several men in the crowd. When the fans jumped into a taxi to get away, Biggie and his companion gave chase, caught the cab a block away, then proceeded to smash the vehicle's windows with baseball bats. After his arrest, Biggie was forced to plead guilty to criminal mischief and harassment. 3 months later, he was arrested in New Jersey for robbery and aggravated assault. Though the robbery count was dismissed, the charge of assault still hung over Biggie at the time of his death. In July of 1996, Police in Teaneck, New Jersey, raided the Courts of Glen Point townhouse that Biggie had purchased for $310,000 8 months earlier and confiscated an infrared rifle, a submachine gun, several automatic handguns, a revolver, a huge cache of hollow point bullets, and the rapper's marijuana stash. Assorted weapons and narcotics charges that resulted from the raid were pending at the time of his death. Biggie was arrested again in September of 1996, 2 days after Tupac Shakur's death, when he and several other rappers were caught smoking pot in Biggie's limousine while it was parked in Brooklyn. That same month, Biggie's left leg was fractured in three places when Lil Caesar lost control of Biggie's SUV on the New Jersey Turnpike. He spent 2 months at the Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation and was still in a wheelchair when the clinic released him just before Thanksgiving. Biggie's deepest fears, however, arose out of the hatred Tupac Shakur had harbored against him ever since the shooting at Quad Studios. Biggie insisted he had nothing to do with that attempt on Tupac's life, but the release of his record, Who Shot Ya, while Shakur was in prison at Dannemora, was widely perceived as a taunt. Biggie at first seemed to view the East versus West feud as grand theater, a terrific publicity stunt that would help both sides sell records. When Snoop Dogg and the Dog Pound began shooting their mocking New York, New York video in Times Square, Biggie went on local radio to tell one station's listeners, "This is our city, and you know the beef we have with these motherfuckers." Biggie laughed off the fool from his neighborhood who emptied a pistol into one of the Death Row Crew's trailers, but began to realize how serious the war between Bad Boy and the Los Angeles label had become in July of 1996, when he went to Atlanta on behalf of Puffy Combs to perform at a huge outdoor concert where Suge Knight was represented by Tupac Shakur. During Biggie's set, Shakur's crew began to chant, "Tupac, Tupac, Tupac." Then, on the way to their hotel after the concert, Biggie and his bodyguards became convinced that they were being followed by a van filled with paid killers. Biggie's bodyguards had their Glocks locked and loaded as the vehicle they rode in made a series of reckless lane changes before speeding onto an interstate highway. The van stayed with them, though, and soon was joined by a pickup. The three vehicles shadowed one another for nearly an hour before Biggie ordered his driver to stop and his bodyguards prepared for a shootout. Only then did the van and truck speed away. After Tupac released his "I Fucked Your Bitch" record, Biggie shot back with "Dumb Rappers Need Teachin', Lesson A, Don't Fuck With B.I.G., That's That." And he seemed almost to be boasting when he spoke about the feud with Tupac for the documentary Rhyme or Reason. One man against one man made a whole West Coast hate a whole East Coast and vice versa. Biggie's attitude became much more sober after Tupac's death, however. "I had nothing to do with any of that Tupac shit," he told Spin magazine. "That's a complete and total misconception. I definitely don't wish death on anyone. I'm sorry he's gone. That dude was nice on the mic." Biggie even admitted how afraid for his life he had become. "I think about it every day," he told MTV. "Every day it's real. That's how real it is. I think somebody's trying to kill me. I'd be waking up paranoid. I'd be really scared." Nothing demonstrated how seriously Biggie took his situation more than his sudden embrace of the Christian faith that was central in his mother's life. In Los Angeles, he'd gotten his first and last tattoo, a scroll of parchment printed with a long passage from Psalms 27. "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the truth of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even my enemies and foes, came upon me in the flesh, they stumbled and fell." Biggie had seemed to publicly proclaim his religious conversion by wearing a large crucifix to the Soul Train Awards. Biggie wrestled more with his fear than his faith on life after death. The album opened with the thump of a beating heart. Over that, Biggie began talking on the phone to Puffy Combs, telling his producer that he had been thinking about suicide. Gunshots cut the conversation short and Biggie fell to the floor. Then Puffy was at Biggie's bedside in the hospital, telling him they were an unstoppable pair, destined to rule the world, and that they had a lot of living left to do. His voice was gradually drowned out by the flatline tone of Biggie's heart monitor. On "Miss You," a rap dedicated to a friend who had been shot dead on the street in Brooklyn, Biggie admitted that he cried for 3 days afterward, even though the deceased was a thug. Life After Death ended with a song that featured Faith Evans, "You're nobody till somebody kills you" was his favorite cut on the album, Biggie told Billboard, because it brings to mind the expression, "You'll miss me when I'm gone." When Biggie arrived in Los Angeles during early February of 1997, though, he tried once again to sound unflinching. If he had to pick, his choice for a home would be the East Coast, because that was where he grew up, Biggie rapped in a song for his new album called Going Back to Cali. But that didn't mean a nigga couldn't rest in the West. California had the weed, the women, and the weather, Biggie told the source. He confided to an interviewer from Vibe that he was going to buy a house in L.A. and insisted, "I get love out here. And if they don't love me, they are going to learn to love me. If I'm scared, I'll get a dog." Biggie sounded more worried about flying to London than about whatever risks he faced in L.A. when he phoned his mother from his suite at the Westwood Marquee on the afternoon of March 8th. Biggie had been scheduled to leave that morning for a promotional tour in Europe, but Puffy canceled the trip. Just as well, Biggie said, since he didn't feel that enough bodyguards had been hired for the week he was to spend in London. He had off-duty cops guarding him in L.A., Biggie told his mother, and felt safe with them around. Her son told her he was going to a party that night, Valletta Wallace recalled, but only because Puffy wanted him there. The night before, Biggie had told a Vibe reporter that he was no longer ready to die. "I think there are a lot more lessons that I need to learn. There are a lot more things I need to experience, a lot more places I need to go before I can finally say, okay, I had my days." When he lumbered out of his hotel suite that night, though, Biggie wasn't wearing the bad boy medallion Combs had given him, that diapered baby wearing work boots and a baseball cap. Instead, the rapper wore a golden Jesus hanging on his cross. Chapter 7. On April 16th, Russell Poole learned that he would not be one of the four RHD detectives sent to New York to interview Puffy Combs and the others who had been part of the bad boy entourage on the night of Biggie Smalls' murder. Fred Miller had made the decision that Poole was to prepare witness interview packages for the other four detectives, but stay behind to sort through the detritus of the Wilshire Division's investigation. Follow-up, it was called. Poole was not happy. "I was used to watching Fred divvy out most of the hard work to other detectives," he explained, "but when you're a lead investigator on a case, you don't want other detectives doing the witness interviews." Poole already felt apprehensive about how the murder book on the Smalls case was being assembled. "These reports are not just the official record of a case, they're also where any new detective who joins an investigation is supposed to begin. But they also eventually become public record, and it was made clear to me that this was a very important consideration in robbery homicide. I'd already seen how careful they were downtown about what went into the record on the Gaines-Liga investigation, and they were being even more selective about what they put into the Biggie Smalls murder book. So much was purged or added to change the appearance of the book on the Smalls case that to me it bordered on fraud. And in both investigations, nearly everything that was changed involved clues that linked the LAPD to Death Row Records. The first political hot potato to land in the lap of the investigators assigned to the Smalls case was the news media's discovery that at least six off-duty police officers had been working for Puffy Combs and Biggie Smalls on the night of the murder, and that the only one of them who witnessed the shooting had left the scene without making a statement to the LAPD's detectives. Inglewood police officer Reggie Blaylock had been the driver of the black blazer that served as the trail car in the bad boy entourage as it left the Peterson Museum. Blaylock eventually would provide a detailed account of his observations, but that was more than a month after the murder, however, and by then the media was having a field day with the story. Officers may have seen rap killing. Off-duty officer was behind vehicle when rap star Notorious B.I.G. was slain, and undercover New York agents were trailing the singer that night, sources say, read the headline on the Los Angeles Times story. Damian Butler, James Lloyd, and Greg Young all told the Times that LAPD investigators had shown them surveillance photos of Biggie and Puffy that were taken in Los Angeles around the time of the Soul Train Awards. One picture had been snapped as late as 10 minutes before the killing, according to the Times story. "If they were there all that time before, it just seems impossible to me that they didn't see the incident," D-Rock told the Times. "Where did they go? They had to see it." In fact, the two undercover New York agents were a detective from the NYPD's Major Crime Squad and an officer from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The NYPD detective was looking for a man who had shot an undercover cop in New York and was believed to be employed by Puffy Combs. The ATF agent was investigating reports that Bad Boy Entertainment was involved in illegal gun sales. The two had abandoned their surveillance on the evening of March 7th, immediately after the Soul Train Awards. It was the NYPD detective who had told the LAPD that they needed to find and interview Officer Reggie Blaylock. Blaylock, who said he had been recruited to work for Puffy Combs by Kenneth Story at a gym where they worked out together, gave investigators an account of the evening that ran to 6 pages, single-spaced, yet added little to what police already knew. The only real revelation was that Puffy Combs had loaded 2 young women into his Suburban before leaving the Peterson Museum's parking structure. Of all those who made up the Bad Boy security detail, Blaylock seemed most impressed by Eugene Deal, whom he described as Biggie's personal bodyguard. Neither he nor Deal had observed any tension between Biggie and the Crips who approached the rapper briefly during the Peterson party, Blaylock said. The Inglewood officer agreed with Paul Offord that a white SUV had tried to pull between their black Blazer and the green Suburban Biggie rode in, and provided a definitive description of the vehicle driven by the shooter. A late model Chevrolet Impala SS, black, with large wide tires, that was very clean. He never saw the shooter's face, Blaylock said, only his hand as he stuck a semi-automatic pistol through the open window and fired off 4 quick shots, followed by another burst of 3 shots. I can only say the hand was lighter than mine, Blaylock said. For the LAPD detectives, the part of Blaylock's story most difficult to swallow was that he tried to pursue the Impala, but the car had vanished by the time he turned right on Wilshire Boulevard. There's no way Blaylock lost the Impala, Poole said. No experienced police officer could have lost that car that fast under those circumstances. I think he backed off because he knew it was going to be bigger than anything he had imagined. That's why he left that night without giving a statement. He knew he was in deep shit for working without a permit and didn't want to answer questions if he didn't have to. Blaylock eventually would receive a 24-day suspension for accepting private security work without proper authorization. But Poole was far less interested in what happened to the Inglewood policeman than in persistent rumors that LAPD officers in the employ of Death Row Records had been at the Peterson Museum party and might have been involved in the murder. Normally I would have just shrugged that stuff off, Poole said, except for the reports I'd heard about Kevin Gaines's involvement in criminal activities connected to Death Row, and what I read in the report by the Long Beach detective who was working for the federal task force. Also, the interview with Reggie Blaylock made me realize that all of the cops who were working security for these rappers must have had the same thought at some point. If shit goes down, what am I going to do? And when you look back at the El Rey Theater incident, what did they do? They ran like scared rabbits instead of being witnesses, because they needed permits to work for these rap labels and they didn't have them. Suge Knight had to have known all this. He's very shrewd, and he knew police departments wouldn't let their officers work for him or his organization. So the ones who crossed the line and worked for them anyway, he had them by the balls. And when you have policemen in your pocket, you're one powerful gangster. He wanted to follow up on the rumors of an LAPD Death Row connection, Poole said, but Fred Miller dismissed them as crap and insisted that they concentrate for now on Biggie's associates and whatever evidence already had been assembled. Poole and other detectives assisting the investigation wasted dozens of hours reviewing more than 30 videotapes that had been seized from surveillance cameras at the Peterson Museum, from a nearby AM-PM mini-mart, and from the City National Bank branch that was directly across from the shooting scene. The LAPD brass became very excited when they learned that a woman from Houston had called the television program America's Most Wanted to claim a friend of her daughter had videotaped the Biggie Smalls shooting. The tape in Texas would be instrumental in solving the case, LAPD spokesman Ross Moen told reporters. When detectives flew to Houston to take a look, however, they discovered that all the videotape showed was Puffy Combs' Suburban leaving the museum's parking structure and heading north on Fairfax to the intersection with Wilshire. Gunshots could be heard in the background, but by the time the camera panned back to the green Suburban, the black Impala was gone. LAPD crime scene logs for the early morning of March 9th did reveal that someone driving a black Ford Bronco had fired a single gunshot in the vicinity of the west side of the Peterson Museum about 10 minutes before Biggie Smalls was murdered, and that LAPD officers were en route to the location when that black Impala pulled up next to Biggie's Suburban on the east side of the building. It looked at first like a planned diversion, but detectives who interrogated the young man they arrested for negligent discharge of a firearm decided he was probably telling the truth when he claimed that his .25-caliber automatic had fallen out of the map pocket of his Ford Explorer and hit the pavement as he was climbing out of the vehicle where he had parked it on Orange Grove Avenue. Worried that his weapon might be damaged, the kid said, he'd fired it into the air to make sure it was still working. When the team of four detectives Miller had dispatched to New York City returned to Los Angeles during the last week of April, they had little to show for their trip. Gregory Young, who had been sitting right next to Biggie when he was shot, would provide the LAPD with no new information. Young said, "Puffy has told us that if our names even appear on a witness list, we're out of a job," Poole recalled. What made this threat amusing was that the very first name on the LAPD's list of witnesses in the Biggie Smalls case was Sean Puffy Combs. Puffy was no help to the LAPD detectives either, however. Interviewed at his attorney's Park Avenue office, Combs not only said he knew nothing about Biggie's murder, but denied even that there had ever been any rivalry between Bad Boy Entertainment and Death Row Records. Damian Butler also offered little, although he did confirm that Biggie had attended a celebrity basketball game at Cal State Dominguez the day before his murder. D-Rock told detectives as well that Biggie had not moved out of the Four Seasons Hotel in L.A. because of security concerns, but because the management asked them to leave after a loud altercation between Biggie and his Philadelphia girlfriend, Tiffany Lane. The L.A. investigators suspected that the women who were traveling with the Bad Boy contingent at the time of the shooting had included D-Rock's girlfriend Aisha Foster and three companions from Brooklyn who had flown west to party with Biggie and his crew. Foster, though, insisted that she and the other three women were on the sidewalk outside the Peterson Museum when Biggie was killed and heard the gunshots but never saw the shooter. Paul Offord was the most forthcoming of the Bad Boy group, and the first to tell the LAPD that when Biggie came out of the Peterson Museum that night, several young black men in the crowd began shouting and throwing West Coast signs. He was uncomfortable and concerned, Offord said, which was why he focused so intently on the white Toyota Land Cruiser that tried to cut between his black Blazer and the green Suburban carrying Biggie. The Land Cruiser, it turned out, was being driven by its owner, Ernest Troya Anderson, who, along with his friend Scott Shepard, had followed Biggie to L.A., hoping to pitch their plans for a series of parties all across the country to celebrate the rap star's 25th birthday in May. There was no evidence to implicate either Anderson or Shepard in the murder. Offord said he was so distracted by the Land Cruiser, though, that he had not even seen the black Impala on the other side of the Suburban Biggie was riding in, at least not until he heard shots and turned to see the gun in the hand that was extended through the Chevrolet's open window. All the LAPD detectives agreed that the most impressive of the New York witnesses was Eugene Deal, and that Deal had provided the only really compelling information. This involved Deal's observation of a black male wearing a bluish-gray suit with a bow tie, whom he had seen standing on the east sidewalk of Fairfax Avenue as Biggie and Puffy were preparing to leave the Peterson Museum. The man, who appeared to be a black Muslim, seemed to be checking them out, Deal said, then walked north on the sidewalk in the direction from which the black Impala would come less than 10 minutes later. James Lloyd provided no more information about Biggie's death than did Puffy Combs, but Lil Cease did give his most detailed description to date of Tupac Shakur's shooting at Quad Studios 3 years earlier. "He knew Tupac believed that Biggie and Puffy were responsible," said Lloyd, who denied any knowledge of this. Unlike Puffy, though, Lil Cease admitted that there was hostility between Bad Boy and Death Row, and that it had caused us all trouble in any number of cities where Puffy Combs' performers appeared.
All righty. Audio segment number one. We'll pick up. We will be, in the middle of chapter seven, once we get back to the second set of audio. The number, folks have comments here to share, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. 7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. Let's see, we had a number of folks who wrote in, so we'll get a few of the emails in first, and then we will nab callers. So email number one. Alrighty, listener wrote in, hey Gus, loving the commentary on the new book. I wish I could participate live because I've studied a lot of this material literally my whole adult life. While there are many valid points, some things contradict what was revealed through the passing of time, such as the revelation of Dexter Isaac committing the Quad Studio shooting in 1994, as well as Jimmy Henchman being behind it, and Mr. Henchman being publicly identified as a government informant. He's another person that was allowed to wreak havoc, and it wasn't revealed until many years later that he was working with the government, which is just another piece to the puzzle. Incidentally, now, I'd have to get more information to see if that's accurate, that Dexter Isaac, that he's been accurately identified. They've got evidence and everything that, yes, this is, or at least one of the people who participated in the Quad Studio shooting 1994. So much in this book that, oh yeah, Diddy and Notorious B.I.G. did this, you know, they were there at the time and looked all suspicious and all the rest of, like, get out of here with this rumor. And the Negroes did it. Negroes are always guilty. Continuing, like it was stated earlier, there's no evidence, important E word, for many of these claims, such as Suge and his goons dragging Jimmy Iovine or kidnapping Happy Walters. A lot of this just seems to be folk tales of the black boogeyman. Not to say Suge didn't do his part of terrorizing people, it just seems exaggerated, especially without evidence. There's people that worked for Death Row, like James Mob James McDonald, who speaks freely about much of this, and he rebukes many stories and confirms some as well. The Warren G story has been told over and over by people who were there on both sides. Nobody ever mentioned what Randall Sullivan is saying happened. Sam Snead is reported by people who were there that he was beaten because of a music video he had that had no Death Row artists in it, but also so-called East Coast artists in it. It is also reported that it was as a way of getting back at Dr. Dre for leaving. I feel Mr. Sullivan is just taking frameworks of stories and just adding what he wants to help with his conclusion of what happened with the murders, especially after he ended Chapter 4 with Suge couldn't let Tupac leave Death Row. Mr. Randall reported that Tupac sent a letter to the Bad Boy offices that seemed like a COINTELPRO tactic of sending letters to a so-called rival. For me, this just shows the importance of victims attempting to minimize at least public feuds with other victims, because racists have shown for centuries they know how to exploit black people, non-white people's conflicts. Absolutely. It was said that the Kenner firing played a role in Tupac getting killed. Oh yeah, last, that was an important one. One of the more important ones in the book. People predicted, you fire this white man, you're going to die, and he died days later. But it's also reported that Kenner was fired because Tupac was starting his own label to be distributed through Death Row. He had completed his contractual obligation to Death Row, and Kenner couldn't be an attorney for the distributor and Tupac's label. That was a conflict of interest, allegedly. I could be nitpicking, but something this serious should be more accurately reported. I don't think that's nitpicking, even if we were just talking about anything. Ducks. Weather. Where did you get this information? Let's not be sloppy about things. They were trying to explain the heat wave that we had here in Seattle. Let's give some detailed analysis that makes sense, not just throwing things out that I'm making up, you know. Anyway, accurately reported on. I agree. Tupac actually drove to Las Vegas, not flew like Randall Sullivan reported. It's little details like this that always made me skeptical about information that isn't sourced throughout this book, when details that are easily verifiable are wrong. That is huge, in my opinion. I've said that before. We talked about it with a number of other books. I mean, just simple sloppiness. This gets made into a major motion picture. Like, you got researchers, right? You're a major journalist. You write for the Rolling Stone, Washington Post, and all that. You're a white man. You got access to one of the lead investigators on the case. Like, shouldn't be any errors. You got paid lots of money. This is a bestseller. Shouldn't be any errors. Unless these are not errors. These are deliberate deceptions. That's something else. Continuing, let's see. Also, it was left out that David Kenner brought Michael Harry O. Harris a substance called Guillain-Barré, which causes paralysis, right when he was taking legal action against Jimmy Iovine and Suge. Like you said, if someone is going to arrange a murder, they wouldn't be in close proximity of the alleged target. That's why I always had problem with the narrative of Suge Knight killing Tupac while he was sitting across from him. I don't think it's a farther reach to suspect Kenner possibly wanted both to be killed during the shooting, but since Suge wasn't, he was put into greater confinement. That's right, immediately. It was said that Suge had great admiration for the mafia figures, which I feel contributed to his behaviors of imitating them. I think time has revealed to him that his fate hasn't been what the white mobsters' fates have been for all their actions on the street. Jimmy Henchman, Tupac, Tut, and Dexter Isaac's robbery confession. Oh, and then they have, we've got a video y'all can check out. More information about the, this is the 1994 Quad City shooting that we're talking about here that Tupac survived. All right, so other emails to go, just trying to get them in as we proceed. Folks who dialed in, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Let's see. Oh, folks are spectating. I will not waste time since we have so many emails. I'll just read more of the emails and tell folks get their thoughts together. Let's see. Next email. All righty. Different caller. All right. So this person, they went to check out the film City of Lies. Okay. There's a podcast about this book, the film, the cases, all of that. I don't think Randall Sullivan's been on there, but some of the other folks have. They talk about the movie and all that. So his main points. Number one, the name of the white man who made the movie City of Lies, which is based on this book, the name of the film director is Brad Furman, not spelled the way Mark Furman's name is. Brad Furman's name is F-U-R-M-A-N. Mark Furman is F-U-H-R-M-A-N. Anyway, presumably not related to Mark Furman, though it is unknown if either have siblings. Number two, the Brad Furman meeting Arthur Randall Sullivan in Portland right down the road and describing it as a love affair. I don't know what that means. 20 minutes into the interview, so Furman goes on this podcast. 20 minutes into the interview, the topic of the fictional character played by Forrest Whitaker is discussed and is described as his only criticism of the screenplay, and other people, white no doubt, insisted this character be inserted. It seems unclear whether this change was to further dramatize the story, think the character getting stopped, harassed, and arrested, or to diffuse the optics of rooms full of white men fighting over whether to solve the case or not. My opinion of the film is the change was for the latter. Now, this is something that I've talked about for pretty much the entire time we've been reading this book. I hadn't seen this film, didn't know about it at all, City of Lies, until we started reading this book. Then once I see it, I'm like, whoa, why would they get this like major black actor. They didn't even get a black nobody. Forrest Whitaker, Academy Award winner. Why would you get him to portray a fictional version of this white author and then make him being a black male like a part of the storyline? Why would you do that? Why not just get a white guy to, you know, be Randall Sullivan? You can still fictionalize the character, but get a white man. Randall Sullivan's white. Why do this? Why, non-white narrator for this book, too. Talked about that last week. Number four, the director spent great effort to make contact with Miss Wallace and to have her portray herself, and he said he considers her a friend. This rubbed me as an exploitative of a grieving victim of white supremacy to be dragged into doing something she disagreed with doing. Miss Wallace wanted Angela Bassett to portray her again, but the white director had other plans. Interesting. Now, in my opinion, getting Miss Wallace, Christopher Wallace's mother, that gives more authenticity, right? In my opinion, that, number one, hey, Miss Wallace is signing off on this project. She agrees with what we're doing, the book, all of that. And she's in the film. You hear her voice talking about what happened to her son and all of that. Like, that lends so much credibility to people who, you know, they saw this and they know who she is. They know her voice. Like, oh, Miss Wallace. Oh, yeah, this is legit. Yeah, City of Lies. If they didn't, and they find that out, like, oh, wow, they got Big's mom in it. That's amazing. Like, yeah, every City of Light and or Labyrinth, either or, because people don't read. But we have to get into more of the details once I get to some of my notes and other folks. I'll check again. Then we have other notes as well. Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida. See one hand. Break up some of the emails that we have. If you have commentary, sure, sir, should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I heard in the first clip a familiar brief history of what is called rap music. That it has a base in the Caribbean. And I've also heard that point argued about somebody in this part of the world called the United States. To me, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. I'm not a fan of rap at all. Primarily because I don't like anybody talking over music that I'm familiar with. A lot of the sounds that is called music with rap is actually was produced back in the 1970s. I guess it was called funk back during that time, also in the first period, you know, when I'm not talking about the writer right now, just in general, the historical analysis and whatnot, a question just comes to my mind, with all of this that was going on, and still is going on to some extent, when it comes to, what is called rap. What is the intention? What is the overall intention of it? What does it seek to accomplish? Those questions come to mind. Because, I mean, this writer may have his way of doing things as a white person, but some of this stuff actually happened. Some of the stuff that he's writing about actually happened. And it reminds me of Neely Fuller's those four things that one should consider in their act of doing something. what am I doing, why am I doing it, how do I go about doing it, and what do I expect the constructive outcome to be. And I don't see a whole lot of constructive outcomes in a lot of these things that I'm listening about, you know, when it comes to especially between the murders of these two young non-white black males, and in between a whole lot of other things that's not too constructive going on. And it didn't start with them as far as entertainers or the entertainment industry where non-white people are at. I mean, one of my favorite singers, Sam Cooke, was murdered back in 1964. You know, so, you know, I mean, it didn't start with what I identified people young enough to be my sons and daughters. But just that thought just comes to my mind as I'm listening to the book, because I mean, if I don't care if somebody give me all of the money in the world, if I got to be looking over my shoulder, have bodyguards with me everywhere I go, I'm just trying to figure out what's the use, you know, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Not a hip hop fan. Uncle Luke would be so disgusted. Let's see. I'll keep an eye on
him. And I know him.
Let's see. From
chapter, as a football coach.
Yes, sir. From chapter 6. I'll keep an eye on the switchboard. Folks have other comments, questions they want to sneak in. *61, and I'll get in our other emails as well. From chapter 6, Mr. Sullivan says, the greatest obstacle in investigating the murder of Biggie Smalls was that almost no one who had been present at the scene wanted to talk to the cops. Now, this is a very common cliche. It's right up there with black people are lazy. Black people don't read, black people like fried chicken, and black people don't snitch. They won't talk to the police. Now, there may be an element of truth to that. I think retired firefighter just used that, parroting, they say. May be an element of truth to that in terms of black people not being enthusiastic about cooperating with the Mark Furmans of the world. But is the greatest obstacle the reason for this? Is it that Mark Furman just happened? I feel like so frequently when these type of things are stated, there's no context. We're talking about a shooting that happened in 1997. So this is 2 years after Mark Furman, same city. Matter of fact, we can go all the way back. This is 1991. This is 6 years after the beating of Rodney King, same city. 5 years. L.A. riot, same city. 2 years, Furman tape, same city. That wouldn't be reason, justification for black people maybe being a little bit hesitant about, oh, yeah, I want to go chat it up with LAPD. Bring Mark Furman over here right now. I got something to tell him about what happened to this black fella. The Christopher Commission, I forgot that. They just had that big report that had come out circa 3-4 years before all of this. Next, gang. Now, I talked about the vernacular of Mr. Sullivan. Now, he's used the term gangbangers and a few others, penitentiary niggers. He was quoted that one. This one, he says black gangbangers. I don't know. I generally don't hear people use the term gangbanger talking about anyone but black people. I don't mean non-white people. I mean black people, individuals classified as black specifically. He even has a double whammy on those black gangbangers, as if they're any other type of gangbanger. He didn't call those cops last week gangbangers. He called them yahoos. Remember that one? Let's see. Same day, however, LAPD. Same day, an LAPD lieutenant was quoted in the Times as saying that police believed Biggie Smalls' death had been a hit, a directed target coming out of New York, Los Angeles, or Atlanta. The head of the New York Police Department's anti-gang enforcement section was even more explicit. All indications are that Biggie Smalls' murder was a retaliation for Tupac Shakur's murder. Now you want to talk about evidence and show cause. I do not profess to have, you know, any sort of degree in criminology. I've never had a job in law enforcement. All of that conceded. My general sense is that when there is a murder or any sort of serious crime, you generally do not come out and, oh yeah, we think this was, let's investigate. We don't want to, what they call it, tip our hand. We don't have a suspect in custody, so we want to shut up, do our investigation, let us do our work, and then we will share. Not jumping the gun and, oh yeah, this was an organized hit in New York, Atlanta. I mean, what? You're putting exact cities and cities that are very far apart. Like, where are you getting this information from? And in my opinion, the caller talked about, or the person who wrote and talked about being accurate, when you have a major crime, a murder as it were, and it seems like a part of this is all kinds of rumor and falsehoods and incorrect information, that's been a theory and a theme in all of our LA books, O.J. Simpson, all the rest of it. Man, strive for accuracy and let's have some evidence. This is not just going to be, we're just, you know, any old thing that you heard from somebody, or I saw this in a movie, or it was written on the bathroom stall, so it's got to be true. Like, no, let's, or at least let's share that. This is my theory and I got it on the bathroom stall. That's, we know how much stock, how much validity do I place on your theory. Let's see. The first question Russell Poole asked was why the LAPD's major crime unit hadn't taken over the Smalls murder investigation until 4 weeks after Biggie's death. I couldn't recall a single other murder case with that kind of high profile where major crimes wasn't called in right from the start. Now, I got to get to the other half. That's huge, too. But let's stop right there. Now, this is from the O.J. Simpson case and others. Anytime you have a major case, especially a murder, where you start having irregularities, this is our normal protocol when we have a murder, a major crime. We have a major crimes unit. They, bam, immediately come in and get to work. These are the folks who have expertise. Let's get the clues. We don't do that here. And I mean, hey, this is happening after the debacle at the O.J. Simpson trial. Haven't we had enough high-profile cases that fell apart in an embarrassing manner for the LAPD? We don't want to have a replay of that. Let's get this forensics done in A-plus fashion. This is going to be the epitome of a textbook criminal investigation. Oh, no. We wait a month before major crimes come. Anything like that, that to me suggests we don't really. Nobody who will be missed. Another dead Negro. Let's see. Oh, yeah, let me get the other part. So they say all that. No major crimes called in. The brass gave an explanation that they needed the resources for the Ennis Cosby case. But that was bullshit. Woo! The timing of the context of white supremacy. Like, I take these little clues. Anything like this that happens, and we've had so many of them over our history with the book club. Like, woo! We are where we are supposed to be. Time, place in the universe. Bill Flippin Cosby released from greater confinement yesterday. And we're reading today the excuse given in 1997 as to why major crimes not called in immediately. We got to wait a month before we get them on the Christopher Wallace murder case is because Ennis Cosby. Was Ennis Cosby's murder solved? Did they get the fellas? Did major crimes, did they, since they got to have all this manpower, as it were, did they solve that case? And that's a cowbell for sure. That is a cowbell right there. Like, whoo, I cannot believe. We'll have to dig that one as we are proceeding. But Enos Cosby's killers, were they brought to justice? Are they in greater confinement right now? Have to get that. I didn't even think, I wouldn't begin to think, Enos Cosby, is that LA too? Oh my God, is that the same time period? Really? Woof. Continuing, same page, Poole was even more troubled when he looked at the logs for the first 24 hours after Biggie's murder and discovered that the four robbery homicide detectives and RHD lieutenant had been at the hospital and the murder scene during the early morning hours of March 9. I never could get an explanation of why they didn't take the case right then, Poole recalled. It was perplexing, to say the least. That perplexing, yes. But if you're not taking the case, why are you present? What are you doing? Are you at the hospital in an investigative capacity? Is this your free time? What are you doing if you're not there for the case to help eventually solve this crime? Are you a looky-loo? What's going on here? I don't even have a fill-in. I'm sincerely curious. Next. Oh, God. All right, so then, that's what I mean. Now, particularly if we're not going to have footnotes and you're just going to come with any quote of nonsense or whatever, yet another anonymous informant, this one offering a more detailed story than any of the others, said the East versus West feud had turned deadly during the summer of 1996 when Puffy Combs placed a contract on Suge Knight and offered a reward to anyone who could bring him a death row medallion. Okay, all of that, no footnote at all. Who is this anonymous informant? Where did you, is any of this substantiated? Do you have dates, evidence, any witnesses to support any of this? If this is the type of thing, like, we don't know, did you get this from a 14-year-old? Like I said, was this on a chat forum somewhere online? All of these little rumors, oh yeah, Diddy did it. He's some mafia hit person, see, and he did it, he was trying to get the medallion, see, so you can think like, oh yeah, that's right, the Quad City Studio, they robbed him and took his chain, and they were right there, maybe Diddy did it, yeah, maybe they did it. Next. Okay, so Russell Poole had considered the Crips theory dubious from the outset. To me, it was obvious this wasn't a gang shooting. Biggie's murder was much more sophisticated than anything I've ever seen any gangbanger pull off. This was professionally executed. Again, I pause right there. I believe that to be the case for both of these crimes. There were multiple people in both of the vehicles for Mr. Shakur and Mr. Wallace. Nobody else hit. Not one other person. Just presumably the intended target in both cases and fatally executed. These are really, like, in almost use the word military type precision with these hits. And you know, a lot of, we know from Mark Furman that a lot of enforcement officers are ex or military veterans. They have killing combat experience. So if these are that type of precise, professional hits, does Sean Diddy Combs, Biggie Smalls, Little C's, do any of these individuals have any sort of history in the armed services or with, like, professional military style hits, any of these individuals? I've never heard of that. That would be news to me. Evidence, again, they can step forward. And let me just continue. He says, we all knew that it was obvious. Also, the fact that a reward of $25,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of Biggie's killer had been offered by the city of Los Angeles mitigated overwhelmingly against the theory that the Crips had been behind the murder. In my experience, a reward offer of $2,500, 100 in italics, would have solved any crime that was committed by a Crip, Poole said. Somebody would have snitched. I thought they said before that black people don't snitch to the police. Isn't that what they said? They said black people don't snitch to the police. I even got a pause right there. Wait a minute. That's so common, right? They say that black people just won't talk. They make it a part of the Negro culture and heritage that, oh, no, you can't talk to the fuzz. Mm-mm. I won't talk to the man. Mm-mm. No Amber Geiger, no Mark Furman. Mm-mm. And then you say this case could have been solved for 25 cents. Them Negroes will flip on each other for a hamburger. Which is it, man? Just tell me. Just tell me so I can understand. Is it 1 and 1 is 2 or 1 and 1 5? Just tell me the truth. So if the Negroes will snitch and rat each other out for 5 cents, say that every time. Don't say that nonsense anymore about, well, black people just don't talk to the police. And man, black people just don't cooperate. And man, black people just don't talk. And black people, no, 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 no. Black people will rat each other out for 5 cents. We see to that in the system of white supremacy. In fact, we demonstrate that every day in a system of white supremacy. You all do snitch. You cooperate. We make you cooperate with us. Remember Ed Burge in Chicago? Put the electric prod on your testicles. We make you cooperate. Now, continuing. But they said they would have solved this crime for way less. They put $50,000 and didn't get a word. That to me would be another bit of evidence like, wow, this is really professional. Not even any information to snitch. Put as much money down as you want. It will never be collected because there's no one to snitch. Wow. That is, in fact, I was going to say that's military precision. That's like white supremacy precision. Never even get an arrest for the case, which seems intended. We don't even turn it over to major crimes until a month later. And that's the type of thing where I'm thinking, if you're really a gangster, you can do that. You know who to pay. You work with, you've seen The Godfather, right? That's what they said. You know how to make sure crimes don't get solved. Which enforcement officer do I need to be cool with? Which one do I need to make sure? That's going to be my homie. I rub his back, he rubs my back, and, you know, this disappears. I don't think Diddy has that sort of relationship with law enforcement. I could be wrong. I would suspect a David Kenner, white man, to have that sort of relationship. I don't think Suge Knight had that sort of relationship with law enforcement. If he did, he wouldn't have been in greater confinement days after Tupac was killed. Just trying to follow logic, man. That was especially appalling, though, to come back and say all that. And they said that all the time, that black people just don't talk to police. That's why they kill all you niggers in the street in Chicago and everything. That's why they're going to butcher all of you in July 4th in Chicago and elsewhere this weekend, because you don't talk with the police. You don't work with us. Yeah, right. Lots of Welsing moments this week, too. Biggie's look was unlike anything else. A hulking fat boy whose favorite meal was waffles with ice cream and bacon. Biggie's wide, round, pouncy eyes and pudgy, hairless face gave him the look of an immense child, not a man. And the label, Bad Boy. I think we talked about that with Death Row and Black Male in the Electric Chair. I mean, just look at that. These are the icons of what people are listening to. You got a Black Male, Bad Boys, and then Death Row Records, like, I can be a baby or I can die. I'm a death row inmate. Bad Boys and Death Row Inmates. Like, wow. That is the man not right there. Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Cradle to the grave, all in one. Next, the combination of his dark skin and pale pink lips with the pinstripe suits and derby hats he wore suggested a fellow who'd been this is one of the most important sentences in the book. There are certain points where the book differs from the audio narrative, okay? This is one. There have been a few others. I haven't pointed them out because they haven't been, like, substantial. It's just been, like, slight changes, like, I wish I could point and give you one exactly, but I mean, it'd be something really small. We were going to have apples for dinner instead of apples, said we were going to have fruit, but just really small. It's only been like maybe two or three. This is our fourth week, so it's been maybe one a week. This is a major one. So they said specifically, I'm going to give it to you again. The combination of his dark skin and pale pink lips with the pinstriped suits and derby hats he wore suggested a fellow who'd been, this is where it changes, been recruited. It said recruited out of the Chitlin circuit. That's not what it says in the book. In the book, it says a fellow who'd been recruited out of a minstrel show into Al Capone's mob. That's one where I say right there. Now, why do I get Forrest Whitaker to play Randall Sullivan, who thinks Notorious B.I.G. looks like a combination with his dark skin and pale lips with the pinstripe suits and derby hats suggests he thinks Biggie looks like he's been recruited out of a minstrel show to play Al Capone. Why would I get Forrest Whitaker to play a white man who thinks like that about Biggie Smalls or any black person, really? Why would Forrest Whitaker be that person? You can best bring this spirit to life. Yes, Mr. Whitaker. Why was this line changed in the audiobook? Chitlin Circuit is not the same thing as minstrel show. They are way different. Not even close. Why would that have to be changed? And then the same thing I said last week, you change it and then you got to get a black person too to narrate this nonsense with no footnotes and no evidence and all this anti-blackness. You got to get a black guy to play him in the film, and then you got to get a black person, a black guy, to narrate this too. Did anybody else think that Biggie Smalls, that's what he looks like to you? Somebody that they snatched out of a minstrel show to play Al Capone? And he wrote this after Christopher Wallace was dead. That's another thing too. They make a point in the book. Don't call him Biggie Smalls, Christopher Wallace. You don't know him. You weren't friends. Let's just be professional. Be a journalist. Christopher Wallace. Tupac, spell it out. T-U-P-A-C, Shakur, every time. Not Biggie Smalls. None of this because you don't know him. You're not friends. Be a journalist. If you're going to have this type of anti-blackness and you think this is just some gangbang nigger that they pulled out of a minstrel show, then don't call him Christopher Wallace. Don't call him Biggie Smalls or anything else. Call him Mr. Wallace every time. Just be a journalist. Next, let's see. He makes a big to-do about Notorious B.I.G.'s record, Who Shot Ya? And saying that this seemed to taunt Tupac. I said last week, I don't think you would have enough time in an entire summer to listen to all of the rap songs that are titled Who Shot Ya, I Shot Ya, We Shot Ya, or some derivative. And you could just even narrow it to just songs like that that came out in the 90s. You would still end up taking a whole lot of time. Again, now, listening to that song, does that strike you as evidence of, wow, the people who put this track together sound like they know how to coordinate professional military-style hits where there will never be snitches because they don't talk about it? I thought they were making a record bragging about it. No. We coordinate professional military-style hits. Nobody ever talks about it, and we do it so well we can make a song and brag about it. Yeah. Let's see. Anything else? I didn't get to chapter 7, all my notes are chapter 6 thus far. I did have to take notes on chapter 7 as well. I'll double check. Let's see. Some of the other folks who dialed in, we'll get them, and then I'll share any other notes. Just the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. I think you made some very valid points about the contradictions that happens a lot in these books. I know it happened in the OJ book. It just happens all the time. Happened in the Geronimo Pratt book. But I did look up Ennis Cosby. I know you asked about that. I don't know that much, but according to, you know, Wikipedia, you know, in quotes, so they have a, you know, article about him being murdered that the person was arrested, and it happened in January 97, and the person was arrested in March. No citation needed, but it had other articles around that time talking about the person that was arrested. He was convicted, and in 2001, he finally confessed that he was the person. Free White, by the name, I guess, Free White in 18, looked like a Russian name. Because, of course, that was labeled an accident, a robbery, gone bad, or whatever. I know people think other things. I don't know. But he was. Someone was apprehended and convicted. And let me talk about that. Thank you.
Wow. Incredible. Did you? The dates. The dates. My goodness. Now, she said that he was killed in January 1997. Geronimo Pratt was released spring 1997. Notorious B.I.G. killed March 1997. I think that she said that's when Mr. Ennis Cosby's killer was arrested. Kevin Gaines, where we started the book, we haven't even got back to him. That's when he was killed, March 1997. Like, whoa, that is amazing. Wow. Have to go back and look at that. Yes, I know a lot of people, Dr. Welsing included, said that they thought something else happened there, but wow, all of that to happen. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but to answer your question, because you did put a question out there, I never thought of Mr. Wallace as coming from a minstrel show or anything. I mean, I guess because I'm from that area, he just seemed like someone from that area who made music. I didn't think, you know, he earned some money, he put on better clothes. That's usually what people do when they earn more money. They put on, quote unquote, better clothes.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Wow. I am stunned. The Ennis Cotton, not that I knew about that before we talked about it, but I just, that's another, I hadn't really looked at the details of all that case, and then to look at it in the context of this, and then that happened in LA too. Like, wow, that is, wow, wow. And then Mr. Cosby really, woo, context, everything. Other folks who dialed in with the hand up, much obliged, our caller in Georgia.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir. Oh, we did hear you. Now we do not. Mo in Dallas, are you still with us?
My apologies. I accidentally muted myself. I'm here. Again, greetings, guests, greetings, listeners, and callers. Thank you for the program. I will be brief. One of the... I guess the major thing that caught my attention in the reading was the what was major crimes unit transferring or receiving the case 4 weeks after the incident occurred, and understanding that they were present at the hospital. That sounded to me as a suspicious victim. As something that was organized, it seemed as if they could have possibly been monitoring the situation, or you know, kind of like shadowing the investigation. And as a suspicious person, I would say that something like that, that process, the shadowing, would be could be used to distort evidence or mishandle witnesses or mishandle statements. So, if that is the case, a lot of time they do receive the actual case, you know, everything is so jumbled that it's unworkable. It just makes sense to me. And to answer to Gus's question, did Christopher Wallace look like he, belong in a minstrel show or on a Chitlin circuit? No. I'm actually born in the South. I have family, parents that were familiar with with you know, the menstrual times, and it was something that was a topic of discussion in my early childhood, and I don't see that in Christopher Wallace. He just seemed like the previous caller said, like a poor person who ended up, you know, fortunately accumulating enough resources to afford a better appearance. I don't see anything menstrual-like about that. So that's all I have in my mind. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. So at least we got two folks thus far who said no. Biggie Smalls, Christopher Wallace, did not look like he was snatched from a menstrual show to play Al Capone. And that's another where I say the metaphors. Now, some folks could come in and say, well, menstrual show, he probably did mean something similar with Chitlin' Circuit, and he maybe realized that that was, you know, maybe not the best selection. That's another one where I would add, like, this is a book with an editor. Russell Poole is a best-selling author. He wrote, probably read this over many, many times before he submitted it. I'm sure he has white friends. I don't know if he's married or whatever, but his white homies to read it over, white publicist, white editor, like many pairs of white eyeballs read over this document before it was published, and they saw no problem. So you're calling a dead black male entertainer unjustly killed, murder hasn't been solved, we're going to say that he is from a menstrual show? Really? Okay. That's right. I'm like, really? And we're going to go to his mother at some point and say, hey, we're going to adapt this to a movie. Come be a part of this project. Just, you know, you didn't read that part where we said, don't even, just skip that page. Yeah, we'll change it to Chitlin' Circuit when we do the audiobook. So don't even worry about that, Miss Wallace. Yeah. Miss Wallace is a victim of white supremacy. I'm in no way, you know, disparaging her. They take advantage of lots of us. I think victim, can't say it enough. Victim. They exploit. That was the word the person who wrote in said. Exploit. They exploit and take advantage of so many non-white people in so many ways. Necrophilia. Come and mock your dead, murdered child and then have you come and be a part of my project so I can steal some authenticity. Disgraceful all the way. I didn't get all the emails, but, you know, we'll get them as we go. I will assume folks are good for the time being. If you had additional commentary, write it down, and we should have time once we finish with the second audio commentary. So we will pick up. We are still in Lost Money. We're still in chapter 7. Randall Sullivan, no footnote Sullivan, just like old Jeffrey Toobin. I cannot believe that. Enes Cosby, today of all days, right after Bill Cosby is released from greater confinement. Timing is right and exact. Context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
On May 7th, Poole and Miller flew to Las Vegas to consult with the detectives there who were investigating the murder of Tupac Shakur. The LAPD detectives had little doubt that Shakur's death was connected to the shooting of Biggie Smalls. Suge Knight hated Puffy Combs, and anonymous sources had told us that Puffy was responsible for Tupac's death, Poole explained. Knight had told people that Combs had Jake Robles killed, and even though Robles was a total thug, he and Suge were close. Biggie was close to the Crips, and the Crips were who had been implicated in Tupac's murder. No matter how many times Puffy denied it, we knew that Crips had worked as bodyguards for Biggie when he came to L.A. The theory that the Crips were responsible for Tupac's murder was most strongly backed by the bloody gang war that broke out in Compton in the immediate aftermath of Shakur's shooting in Las Vegas. Everyone who lived in Crips territory understood that since people thought Southside had killed Tupac, his people, the mob Piru, would be riding in our neighborhood, a young man named Corey Edwards had explained to the LAPD in a sworn affidavit. Tupac wasn't really from Mob Piru, but that's where Suge Knight grew up, and Tupac was now part of Suge's group. We just warned everyone to be careful. Not everyone was, however. On September 9th, 1996, 2 days after Tupac was shot, a young member of the Southside Crips named Darnell Brims, rumored to have been in the white Cadillac with Shakur's killer 2 days earlier, walked into a liquor store near the intersection of Alondra Boulevard and Atlantic Avenue, right on the borderline between Crips and Bloods territory. Brims had just stepped inside when a Blood, with a gun in his hand, rushed through the door behind him and opened fire. Hit 3 times in the back and buttocks, Brim plunged to the floor. The Blood stepped forward to finish him off, but hesitated when he saw that Brims had used his body to cover the critically wounded 10-year-old girl who lay under him. Whatever measure of humanity remained in the Blood prevented him from firing another shot, and both Brims and the girl, Lakeisia McNeese, survived. So did a pair of Piru Bloods shot in a drive-by on North Bradenfield Street the next day. A Blood, whose brother worked for Right Way Protective Services, was shot several times at the corner of Bradenfield and Pino by Crips who rode in a blue blazer. He also survived. 30-year-old Bobby Finch was not so lucky. Corey Edwards had warned Bobby the day before that the mob Piru would be riding through the neighborhood. But Finch, who worked private security with his brother, a Compton school police officer, knew that gang shootings almost never happened before 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and figured it was safe to drop off his 10-year-old daughter at his mother's home on Compton's south side early on the morning of September 11th. The girl had just gone inside when Bloods opened fire from a passing car and mortally wounded him. Compton PD gang officers had raided a Southside Crip safe house on East Glencoe Street the day before when they were tipped off that a weapons dealer had just delivered a duffel bag filled with guns to the location. Although some of the young men inside escaped, and one, Jerry Monk Bonds, was seen running from the house with a gun stuffed into the waistband of his pants, the Compton cops did seize an assault rifle, 2 handguns, a huge cache of ammunition, and 7 full-face black ski masks. On the evening of Bobby Finch's murder, Compton detectives were contacted by a citizen who said she had just seen several Southside Crips, including Keefe D and Baby Lane Anderson, carrying weapons into a house on South Burris Street. When police responded to the location, they did not see Keefe D, but Anderson was in the front yard. When Anderson ran inside, the police followed him through the door where they discovered an AK-47 assault rifle, 2 shotguns, an M11 assault pistol, and a .38 revolver, along with a good deal of ammunition. Neighbors advised them that the Crips were warning people to stay off the street because it's on, police said. The next day, Compton gang officers reported that their informants said the neighborhood Crips, the Kelly Park Crips, and the Atlantic Drive Crips had joined Southside's army, while mob Pyrus had recruited the Looters Park Pyrus and Elm Lane Pyrus to their side. All Piru groups are aligned with death row records, observed the Compton PD's affidavit, which also reported that the members of Suge Knight's goon squad had been telling the other Bloods that Tupac Shakur's killer was Keefe D's nephew. The next shooting in the gang war took place on September 13th, the day Tupac Shakur died, when a pair of Piru Bloods were murdered by a Crip who approached them on foot. Shortly after the news that Tupac was dead reached Compton, 2 more Crips were shot on South Ward Street. 3 other Crips were shot the next day on Chester Street, and then suddenly the shooting stopped and the war was over. Word spread on the street that maybe it wasn't the Crips who had killed Tupac after all. The Las Vegas police certainly had their doubts, and what just about all the detectives in Vegas seemed to be sure of was that they weren't likely to arrest Shakur's killer. The Las Vegas homicide guys showed us this whole cabinet of clues that they had just sort of filed away and weren't really following up on, Poole recalled. We all talked about what a defense lawyer could do with all the contradictory evidence that had come in. But then the Vegas guys told us that the main reason they would never solve this case was that the politicians didn't want them to. They said the powers that be had let them know the city didn't need an OJ-style circus. I was shocked, but my partner was yucking it up with them and saying he feels the same way about the Smalls case. Fred said, these are just gangbangers with money. The investigation of Tupac Shakur's murder by the police in Las Vegas already had been criticized by an assortment of observers as astoundingly sloppy. Many key witnesses were never interrogated, and those who were said the cops seemed a lot more interested in threatening them than in getting answers to their questions. The more Poole read about the case, the more convinced he became that the Las Vegas police had messed up from the very beginning, starting with the failure of the two bicycle officers who were at the rear of the death row caravan when the shooting started, to secure the scene and detain witnesses. Instead, the bike cops had gone after Suge Knight's BMW, while cars continued to drive through the crime scene for at least 20 minutes, and dozens of pedestrians trampled over evidence. In a large part, this was because the first wave of detectives and canine units were dispatched to the wrong location. Then, no aerial photos were taken, and the Metro Police, who were the first to arrive at the shooting scene, alienated all but one of the eyewitnesses to Tupac's murder. That lone cooperating witness was Shakur's backup singer, Yafu Fula, who assured police he could identify the killer if shown a photograph. Instead of detaining Fula, however, the Las Vegas police let David Kenner persuade them to release the rapper by promising to set up an interview that never happened. 2 months later, the 19-year-old Fula, his torso protected by a bulletproof vest, was shot in the face in the hallway of a New Jersey housing project. He died 9 hours later at Newark's University Hospital. The Las Vegas police had also let Suge Knight skip town without talking to them, although Suge did return 4 days later for the brief interview that the Vegas homicide investigators described to the media as not helpful. Russell Poole, however, was intrigued by what the Vegas police told him about their conversation with Knight. They said the interview was very strange, Poole recalled. Suge Knight had been cut on the side of the head by a piece of glass, but he kept pointing to it and telling them he was hit with a bullet. They thought it was an act, that he had cut himself, and he kept telling them it was the Crips who killed Shakur, which was weird because these gangbangers never snitch on each other. It was only after his trip to Vegas that Poole began to consider another theory of Tupac Shakur's murder that had been floating on the street and in the media. Suge Knight had arranged the hit. Knight hadn't helped to alleviate suspicions by telling ABC's Primetime Live the outrageous lie that a bullet fired by Tupac's killer was still lodged in his head. Then when the network's reporter asked if he had any idea who Shakur's murderer was, Suge answered, "I don't get paid to solve homicides." The rumor that Knight had orchestrated the gang war that began immediately after Tupac's slaying was fueled by the report of a police informant who said Suge had delivered an entire load of AK-47 assault rifles to Bloods gang members at the Nickerson Gardens housing project on the night before the shooting started. Other than Orlando Anderson, the most interesting witness to Shakur's murder among those still alive was Tupac's bodyguard, Frank Alexander. From the beginning, Alexander had described the attack on Baby Lane Anderson at the MGM Grand as an incident that seemed staged. Anderson almost appeared to be waiting for the death row group when it emerged from the Tyson-Bruno fight, Alexander said, and the Crip had not tried very hard, if at all, to escape when Tupac, Suge, and their entourage of Bloods came after him in the hallway outside the hotel's auditorium. Alexander's description of his dealings with Suge Knight in the aftermath of Tupac's shooting was curious as well. Suge brought him out to the Paradise Valley mansion that night, Alexander recalled, and the two met out by the red swimming pool where the only lights were those illuminating the death row emblem that seemed to float like a ghostly stain on the water. When the Las Vegas detectives interviewed Alexander, Suge said the bodyguard should tell them that Orlando Anderson had snatched a chain off Tupac, and that this was what set off the attack on him. Anxious to get out of there, he agreed to whatever Suge wanted, Alexander recalled. On the afternoon of September 13th, though, Suge brought him back out to the mansion, Alexander said, and this time adopted a more threatening attitude. David Kenner was at this meeting, the bodyguard recalled, and so was Death Row's head of security, Reggie Wright Jr. Before he realized what was happening, Alexander recalled, Suge began to blame him for Tupac's death, insisting that the bodyguard should have had a gun on him that evening, permit or no permit. The atmosphere became so ominous that he began to believe he might not leave the house alive, but just when he began to think about making a run for it, the phone rang. When Suge received the news that Tupac was dead, he seemed to forget that Alexander was there. He never saw Suge again after that day, the bodyguard said. After Knight was pulled back into court to face the charge that he had violated probation by participating in the attack on Orlando Anderson, though, Alexander began to receive phone calls on a regular basis from Kenner and Milton Grimes. The lawyers wanted him to testify for Suge, But he answered that he would be a better witness for the prosecution than the defense, Alexander said. Soon after he talked to the Las Vegas police, Alexander was warned by a friend of his who still worked for Right Way Protective Services that Death Row intended to have him killed. That same day, a security guard who was close to Reggie Wright Jr. confirmed what his friend had told him, Alexander said. The bodyguard made one more call, this one to David Kenner, who began to read to him from his interview with the Las Vegas police. He told Kenner that he hadn't said any of those things, recalled Alexander, who nevertheless admitted he was troubled by all the shit that was off on the day Tupac was murdered. The police in Compton, however, continued to insist that their evidence pointed toward Orlando Anderson or one of the other Crips who was in Las Vegas as Shakur's killer. Almost all the evidence the Compton cops had against Anderson and the Crips, however, Poole noticed, was based on anonymous informants. Baby Lane Anderson was a clear cut above the average gangbanger, Poole discovered. He graduated from high school, attended Compton College for a couple of semesters, and had a half-brother that graduated from Berkeley. Word on the street was that Baby Lane, who never had been convicted of a crime as an adult, was the only Southside Crip who didn't drink or use drugs. The kid didn't even have tattoos. Anderson was no choir boy, of course. He had fathered four children out of wedlock by the age of 23, but never once held a job that required him to file a federal tax return. And whatever his involvement in the murder of Tupac Shakur, there was little doubt he had participated in the retaliatory attacks on Piru Bloods that resulted from the murder of Bobby Finch. Tupac Shakur's estate named Anderson as one of two defendants when it filed a wrongful death lawsuit in the rapper's slaying. The other alleged killer named in the lawsuit was Jerry Monk Bonds, who reportedly had been spotted driving a white Cadillac into an auto body shop at White and Alondra in Compton. Corey Edwards, however, told the LAPD that if the vehicle driven by the killers of Tupac Shakur had indeed been the late model Cadillac he saw described in the newspaper, it couldn't have been Bonds's, because that old heap was an early 80s model. Anderson, meanwhile, along with his family and friends, continued to deny that he'd been Tupac's killer. "I just want to let everybody know that I didn't do it," Baby Lane told CNN, claiming that he was afraid to leave his house for fear that he would be killed by someone out to avenge Tupac's death. A lot of things about the way Anderson had handled himself in Las Vegas struck not only Poole, but other detectives also, as curious. When the Vegas police tried to persuade him to fill out an incident report and file a complaint against Suge Knight, Tupac Shakur, and others who had participated in the attack against him at the MGM Grand, Anderson refused. And the MGM security guards said that Anderson didn't want to tell them who had beat him up, Poole recalled. They said his behavior seemed really odd because he wasn't angry at all. He just wanted out of there. Corey Edwards told the LAPD that he saw Baby Lane in the bar of the MGM Grand right after the attack on him, and that Orlando just told him everything was cool. Anderson didn't appear to be too upset about what happened, Edwards recalled. There was something fishy about that whole incident at the MGM Grand, Poole said. I was starting to wonder if it had been staged. Suge Knight might have wanted it on videotape to set up a motive for the killing of Tupac Shakur that would point the blame at the Compton Crips. If that was so, Suge had an ally in Compton's mayor, Omar Bradley, who publicly criticized the police in Las Vegas for not pressing their case against Orlando Anderson. "We arrested someone for the murder of Tupac Shakur," Bradley told reporters. "The Las Vegas police didn't want him. Compton police thought he was the one." Poole was not entirely surprised when he learned that Omar Bradley and Suge Knight enjoyed a cozy relationship. Knight had cooperated with Bradley on a number of civic endeavors and even met with the mayor to discuss financing his run for the Compton District's open congressional seat. Compton, for years, had been the most corrupt municipality in all of California, and Mayor Bradley's commitment to patronage politics was notorious. Among other things, the mayor had appointed his sister to a school board whose other members included a convicted felon and the key witness in a bribery scandal. In 1993, when the State Department of Education discovered that Compton's Unified School District was $20 million in debt, a subsequent investigation revealed a horrific level of failure throughout the small city's academic administration. Feather bedding was so extreme that six secretaries did the work of one, and school buildings had leaky roofs, broken windows, and walls that were literally covered with graffiti. Janitors ignored bathrooms so completely that the stench made state investigators gag when they tried to use them. Despite the fact that student test scores in Compton were by far the lowest in California, Bradley leveled the predictable charge of racism when the state took over administration of the city's schools. It was the same accusation he made against those who insisted upon hounding Suge Knight. On May 27, 1997, Poole found this message on his desk in L.A.'s Parker Center. Officer Knox of LAPD West Valley called. His informant will give you any info you need. The officer's captain will not allow Officer Knox to get involved. Call Officer Knox on 528-97 at 0700 hours, and he will tell you how to get in touch with his informant. Poole had never heard of Senior Lead Officer Kenneth Knox before that day, nor had he been told of this civil abatement action against Suge Knight's recording studios in Tarzana that Knox had undertaken almost a year earlier. Knox's involvement began on June 21, 1996, when he was summoned to a meeting with an aide to Los Angeles City Councilwoman Laura Chick and members of the Tarzana Courts Homeowners Association to discuss numerous complaints about Death Row Records. The meeting was not without a certain droll humor. The small industrial park where Death Row leased its studio space was surrounded by townhouses and condominiums occupied predominantly by wealthy Jewish people. During the past year, these residents had experienced an astronomical increase in the number of assaults, auto thefts, and armed robberies in the area, most of them committed by black gangbangers from Compton. There had been a number of confrontations between gang members who parked their cars in private parking spaces and refused to move when asked. Residents complained that they were afraid to go outside after dark and that even when they stayed indoors, they were tormented by noise from the studio that was both excessive and continuous. 2 days later, Knox and three other LAPD officers arrived at the Can-Am Recording Studios in Suite 211 at Pacifica Industrial Park to verbally admonish Death Row Records. It did not go well. The studio manager, Kevin Lewis, son of the jazz musician Ramsey Lewis, immediately threw up the race card, as Knox noted in his report, and blamed the company that owned the building for any problems the neighbors were experiencing. When Knox explained that many neighbors had complained about seeing armed gang members coming and going from the Death Row studios, Lewis answered that the people carrying guns were not gang members, but off-duty police officers. "Some are your guys," Lewis told him. If they were police officers, a skeptical Knox asked, why were they dressed down like gangbangers? Because the rappers they worked for, including Snoop Dogg and Tupac Shakur, preferred that look, Lewis answered. In his report of this encounter, Knox described himself as shocked, but he shouldn't have been. 5 months earlier, on his very first visit to the Death Row Studios, Knox had encountered in the parking lot a young black male he believed to be a gang member. The young man admitted he was armed, Knox recalled, but then claimed to be an LAPD officer who was working off-duty as a security guard for the record label. Knox was unable to obtain the alleged officer's name, but described the encounter to Captain Robert Gale when he returned to the West Valley station. Gale said it was common knowledge among the department's brass that a number of black LAPD officers were working for Death Row. The day after his first meeting with Kevin Lewis, Knox went back to the Death Row studios with Captain Gale and a West Valley sergeant. As the three strolled through the studios, they saw Snoop Dogg, Tupac Shakur, and MC Hammer, each surrounded by known members of the Mob Piru Blood and Bounty Hunter gangs. Knox met no police officers on this visit to the Tarzana studios, however, and questioned Kevin Lewis on his claim that LAPD officers were working for Death Row. On many evenings, Lewis replied, an LAPD officer from Metro Division sat at the studio's front desk. When Knox said he doubted any LAPD officer would be foolish enough to work for Death Row Records, Lewis just smiled. Knox went back alone 3 days later to tell Death Row's manager that the department wanted to officially register its concern that the presence of so many gang members, unlicensed security personnel, and possibly off-duty police officers increased the possibility of armed confrontations in the neighborhood. A number of local businessmen already had complained that gang members were brandishing weapons at them. Kevin Lewis appeared unimpressed. A series of fruitless meetings ensued between representatives of the LAPD and Death Row Records. Assaults and robberies in the area continued, and on one occasion, a pair of LAPD officers who were working the area's crime suppression detail became involved in a verbal altercation with four Crips in the Death Row parking lot that nearly turned into a shootout. The officers backed off, but then pulled the four over as they drove away because the vehicle they rode in was not registered. A computer check revealed that three of the four were on parole for armed robbery. When the car was searched, the officers found a semi-automatic handgun and two ski masks. They were friends with Tupac and Snoop Dogg, the four said, and had just stopped by for a visit. On July 2nd, Knox informed Death Row Records that LAPD officers were not permitted to work for the record label. An annoyed Reggie Wright Jr. demanded either a meeting with the department brass or a formal letter outlining its policies. 2 weeks later, Knox prepared a memorandum that was distributed department-wide, summarizing his investigation of Death Row Records and warning officers that a supervisor should accompany them during all contacts at the Tarzana Studios. Knox also noted in his memo that no valid work permits had been issued for employment with Death Row Records. Knox made no headway in his civil abatement action until the morning of July 30, 1996, when Kevin Lewis dialed 911 to report that he had been attacked by two men in Death Row's parking lot. He had just arrived for work and was walking from his car to the studios, Lewis said, when he heard footsteps behind him and turned just in time to see the baseball bat that struck him on the top of his head. When he fell to the ground, Lewis said, the man with the bat and another hit kicked and stomped him until he lost consciousness. Police interviewed the Death Row manager at a nearby hospital emergency room, where he received 8 stitches to close the wound on his head, 4 more for a wound on his neck, and treatment for various cuts and bruises on his body. Until this attack, Lewis had been particularly arrogant and obnoxious in his dealings with the LAPD. When Knox had informed him that LAPD officers were not permitted to work for Death Row, Lewis responded that they would make millions of dollars by recording an album about LAPD officers not being allowed to protect Snoop Dogg, as the officer's notes of the conversation described it. In reply to a question from Knox about why Death Row hired only black officers, Lewis said that the only white employees at Death Row Records were the punk rockers he hired as his personal slaves. Lewis's overconfidence, however, was shaken by his beating in the parking lot. Death Row's manager at first told police he knew both his attackers and the person who had sent them after him. The very next day, however, Lewis said he didn't know who had attacked him or why, then insisted that he no longer wanted to press criminal charges. A large man, who had been a college athlete, Lewis made a considerable impression when he admitted he was frightened and did not want to risk retaliation. Lewis became increasingly cooperative after this, however, and Kenneth Knox began to rely upon him for inside information as his civil abatement action turned into an increasingly complex investigation. Knox spent hours on the phone with detectives from the Las Vegas Police Department after Tupac Shakur's murder. At the same time, he consulted regularly with the two federal agents heading up the task force probing Death Row Records, Dan McMullen of the FBI, and John Chacone of the ATF, who provided intelligence information on the alleged involvement of Suge Knight and Death Row Records in a gun smuggling and narcotics distribution ring that operated out of the Nickerson Gardens housing project. Compton detectives, meanwhile, helped Knox compile lists of gang members affiliated with the record label. He soon was considered to be such an expert on Suge Knight and company that Afeni Shakur's New York attorney, Richard Fishbein, phoned Knox to ask for the hierarchy structure of Death Row Records. Reggie Wright Jr. became so accustomed to dealing with Knox that Death Row's director of security freely admitted to the LAPD officer that Suge's personal bodyguards were armed members of the Bloods gang. From the Compton police, Knox learned that there were 3 contracts out on Suge's life, and that the Rolling 60s Crips and the Bounty Hunter Kill Squad both had promised that Suge would be dead before Christmas. Knox observed that Knight now came and went from Death Row Studios in the middle of a 5-vehicle caravan. By the beginning of October, Death Row's Tarzana operation was finally getting the LAPD's full attention. On the first day of that month, 8 LAPD officers responded to a major disturbance call at the Death Row Records studios. The security guard would not let them through the door, but he did step outside to say that an altercation had taken place inside and that he had struggled with a gang member who was trying to use a metal chair as a weapon. The officer saw a bloody towel at the security guard's desk, but the man was reluctant to provide any information, insisting that he did not know the names of the men involved and that they had left the location. The building's night manager, however, told officers that most of the gang members who had started the trouble were still inside, and that he was concerned about the damage they might do if the police left. The LAPD officers then evacuated the studios, and in the course of this action, rounded up 13 suspects, 7 of them members of the mob Piru Bloods. One man wore a bulletproof vest, but if the gangbangers had guns, they were stashed inside. On October 10th, a female LAPD officer from West Valley Division informed Knox that a friend of hers had just sold Suge Knight a yacht, and that he believed Knight was using it to smuggle narcotics and firearms into the country from Mexico. That same day, Kevin Lewis, panicked by the murder of Tupac Shakur, admitted to Knox and an LAPD captain that Death Row had an internal security problem, but he still seemed reluctant to discuss specifics. 5 days later, a man who lived near Death Row Studios phoned the LAPD to report that he had observed prowlers outside his home who seemed to have come from the vacant house next door. When the police arrived, they found the back door of the vacant house open and went inside to check, guns drawn. The prowlers had vanished, but the officers did discover bills of sales for 2 Glock semi-automatic pistols, a Department of Water and Power bill that had been sent to Death Row Records, and a box from a nearby dry cleaners with a receipt bearing the name David Kenner. The next day, 3 members of Tupac Shakur's Outlaw Immortals were arrested and charged with attempting to rob a Decatur, Georgia liquor store with a pistol that had been stolen from a home near the Death Row Studios in Tarzana. 2 days after that, Knox was advised that Suge Knight, detained as a possible prowler outside a condominium in Woodland Hills, had told police officers he lived there with his girlfriend and had lost his keys. The condo had been rented to David Kenner, police learned, and was occupied by a young woman named Latricia Johnson. The Jeep Cherokee and the Mercedes parked downstairs were registered to Kenner, not Johnson. Knox had no clear picture of what had been taking place inside Death Row's studios, however, until Suge Knight was jailed for violating his probation, and Kevin Lewis began preparing to leave the record label. Almost immediately after Knight was locked up in county jail, Lewis phoned Kenneth Knox to ask for police protection, offering in exchange to tell the LAPD a good deal about what he had seen happening around him in recent months. He was a legitimate music producer who had been brought to Death Row in 1994 by Dr. Dre, Lewis wanted Knox to know, and only became involved with the record company because he did not realize that Suge Knight was more of a gangster than a music mogul. He had been planning to leave the rap label since early that summer, Lewis said, but made the mistake of confiding this to a couple of other employees at the record company. The attack in the parking lot took place only a short time later, Lewis said, but being beaten with a baseball bat was a lot less frightening than the mind games Suge Knight began to play with him. One of Suge's favorite forms of torture, Lewis said, was to keep him working late at the studio, let him go home, then phone at 3 a.m. to say, "I need you over here right now." When he complained that he had just gotten to sleep, Suge simply repeated, "I want you over here right now." He'd take a shower, get dressed, and drive to the studios, Lewis said. But each time he arrived, Suge would say, "I just want to see if you'd come when you were called. See you later." Suge also began to send around his crew of thugs to give him the evil eye, Lewis said. Neckbone, Heron, Chili Red, Rock, Trey, Hendog, Lil Wack, and the others were all frightening characters, Lewis told Knox, but none compared to Alton McDonald, Buntree, who with his brothers, Tim and James, were known within Death Row as Suge's killers. In addition, there were a lot of black Muslims around the studios, Lewis said, and especially at Suge's private parties. Suge himself professed to be a Muslim, said Lewis, whose relationship with Mustafa Farrakhan, a childhood friend, had put him in good with Knight when he first went to work with Death Row. Most of the Muslims involved with Death Row, however, had adopted the faith in prison, Lewis said. And like everyone who was part of Suge's inner circle, they considered the time they spent behind bars to be a badge of honor. For these guys, getting out of prison was like graduating from college was for most people, Lewis explained. The atmosphere around the studios had become increasingly scary, Lewis said, since Jake Robles' 1995 killing in Atlanta. He'd been present at the Chateau LeBlanc during the assault on Mark Anthony Bell that December, Lewis said, and was stopped on Suge's orders when he tried to walk upstairs to see what was happening. Particularly unsettling was the way police officers and gang members mixed within death row security detail, Lewis said. Some nights there would be as many as 75 Crips and Bloods in the building. Guns were everywhere, but the worst part was that you didn't know if the guys carrying them were cops or gangsters, because some of the cops acted more like gangsters than the gangsters did. Tupac's murder had convinced him it was time to get away, Lewis said, but by then he had discovered that you didn't just leave death row. At one time, he had believed his father's famous name and the fact that his family's friends included Jesse Jackson, their next-door neighbor in Chicago, would protect him, Lewis said. But Suge Knight didn't give two shits about any of that. Suge was a bad guy. No morals, no heart, no soul, Death Row's former manager explained. Gangbangers who looked like they wouldn't flinch if you put a gun to their heads would leave his office bawling like babies. By the fall of 1996, the stories that circulated through the studios were the kind that you didn't want to repeat to anybody, for fear word would get out that you liked to talk. The whole company was built around fear, and the atmosphere was insane, Lewis said. After Tupac's death, all he knew was terror, the Death Row manager explained. He went days without sleeping and would lie in bed at night wondering when they were going to come for him, and whether they would just beat him up or actually kill him. When Knox asked about the black police officers employed by Death Row, Lewis said that Reggie Wright Jr. dealt exclusively with them, and that he knew very few of their names or what departments they worked for. Lewis did know the name of the LAPD officer who worked the front desk at Death Row, however, and that, Kenneth Knox told Russell Poole, was Richard McCauley.
Context of white supremacy. That's what we'll pick up at next week. We are in Chapter 7, still lengthy chapter, my goodness. Oh well, we'll pick up there next week. Hopefully we'll do a better job ending right on the chapter. They won't be so big, maybe next time. Context of white supremacy, Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The email untiljustice@gmail.com. I think our last email for today, at least, I think, a different person wrote in. Hello, Gus. I hope all is well. Absolutely not. I'm glad that you are doing a study session on the Labyrinth book. This session has been so fascinating to me. The Tupac Biggie case is something that I've followed and researched since the 90s. Although I've only been able to listen from the archives, I'm hoping to catch a live session soon in order to participate. I just wanted to share with you a podcast that I've recently discovered called The Dossier. So that's the one they talked about before. They interview Reggie Wright, blah, blah, blah. Seems to be based around the book Labyrinth and the City of Lies. It is. The host, Don Sikorsky, white man, interviews a few key people involved in the case, including former FBI agent Phil Carson, Reggie Wright Jr., just heard, Gene Deal et al. The host interviewed Brad Furman, heard before, who is director of the City of Lies movie. Apparently the same question you asked on the program regarding why they chose to use Forrest Whitaker to play Randall Sullivan in the movie was a concern to other people. So the host asked Mr. Furman about the decision to use Forrest Whitaker. The discussion on this is in episode 18 of the podcast. Also, the host talks about the racial tension and issues that were dominant during the 90s, Enos Cosby. I think the host questioned a few people from the general public about who they thought were responsible for the murders, and there seemed to be a variety of opinions. No surprise there. Also, I learned in my research that Russell Poole apparently called the then LAPD Chief Parks a house nigger. Not sure how true that is, since it did come from a prison informant and was discussed during a hearing. Based on what I read in the text just through seven chapters and him saying that Biggie looks like he was pulled from a minstrel show, I'm not surprised. Like, this seems like a white person who would call a black person, Chief Parker, a house nigger. Chief Park, excuse me, a house nigger. It would not surprise. And I said just last week, we talked about that. I think Mo in Dallas said, man, I got to count how many times nigger is in the book. I said, it seems like Randall Sullivan enjoys saying nigger. That's another reason why I said they got to get a non-white narrator. Can't just have a white person, nigger this and nigger that, and penitentiary niggers and nigger this and nigger that and nigger this. He just, I mean, yeah, you got to say nigger for NWA and a few other things there. But I mean, this sounds like a white guy who I like to call black people niggers. Yeah, that Chief Parks is a nigger too. A house nigger. OJ is a nigger. Was it Enos Cosby is a nigger. Biggie is a nigger. A minstrel show nigger at that. Puffy's a nigger. All of them. Tupac, they're all niggers. Forrest Whitaker too. 720-716-7300. Code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Do not wait till the last moment if you have commentary. The folks who dialed in, retired firefighter, caller in Georgia, if y'all have commentary, should be with us. Other folks with a hand up, *61, and we'll get you on the line. Folks getting their thoughts together. I will get my notes, make sure I don't lose my chance here. Might even go back. Yes, I can go back and get everything from chapter 7. So in chapter 7, they say, in fact, two undercover New York agents were a detective from the NYPD's Major Crimes Squad and an officer from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The NYPD detective was looking for a man who had shot an undercover cop. Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure I go back and get the whole of it. So, okay. Damian Butler, James Lloyd, and Greg Young all told the Times that LAPD investigators had shown them surveillance photos of Biggie and Puffy that were taken in Los Angeles around the time of the Soul Train Awards. One picture had been snapped as late as 10 minutes before the killing, according to the Times story. If they were there all that time before, it just seems impossible to me that they didn't see the incident. Following logic, where did they go? They had to see it. In fact, the two undercover New York agents were a detective from the NYPD's Major Crimes Squad and an officer from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF. The NYPD detective was looking for a man who had shot an undercover cop in New York and was believed to be employed by Puffy Combs. The ATF agent was investigating reports that Bad Boy Entertainment was involved in illegal gun sales. The two had abandoned their surveillance on the evening of March 7, immediately after the Soul Train Awards. It was the NYPD detective who had told the LAPD that they needed to find an interview officer, Reggie Blaylock. Now, I'm just looking at all this and I'm saying the same thing. How in the world do you have all of these different enforcement agencies? I mean, this is like serious surveillance. You did not just go and get rent-a-cop or some nonsense like ATF, and then from all of these different agencies. Officials from NYPD and all the rest, probably LAPD too. They said they had LAPD bike cops at the back. That was Vegas. Sorry. Vegas shooting, two different to keep in mind. But I mean, same thing, I agree. It's difficult to fathom that you would have all of these refined, skilled enforcement officials there. And just at that moment, minutes before the shooting, they all break and decide they got to go get donuts or use the bathroom or whatever the case. That strains credulity. And the fact that they're there, we think these niggers are up to something. No good nicks. Selling guns and all the rest. Like, really? Where's the evidence of that? And we're just not able to offer any evidence to help in solving this crime. Let's see. Next. They say that Suge Knight had these enforcement officers in his pocket and was in a powerful position because you have to have approval, authorization to do this overtime work, and they didn't have it. John Patash talked about this, and he said that there were many LAPD officers, dozens apparently, who worked for Death Row Records. He posits that they were black and white officers who worked for Death Row. And I just, hey, anybody saying that white people don't work for Death Row, David Kinner is the head of Death Row. What do you mean white people don't work at Death Row? Anyway, John Patash said that, you know, hey, white and black people worked, white and black LAPD officers worked at Death Row. Either way, that also strains believability to think that Suge Knight, some black male, Negro, I got these police officers right where I want them. Like, ooh, I'll get them in all kinds of trouble. Are you kidding me? You'd have to show me all kinds of evidence that he was able to manipulate them in this sort of manner. No white people, just these black. Like, that just doesn't seem logical to me. Let's see. So, Poole and Miller fly to Vegas to investigate the murder of Tupac. The detectives had little doubt that Shakur's death was connected to the shooting of Biggie Smalls. Suge Knight hated Puffy Combs, and anonymous sources had told us that Puffy was responsible for Tupac's death. Poole explained Knight had told people that Combs had Jake Robles killed. And it just goes on, all these anonymous source this and anonymous source that. Do you have any evidence? I mean, even if you have the anonymous sources, is there any evidence to support this goofy theory? Or is this just one bathroom scrolling to the next? Let's see. The theory that the Crips were responsible for Tupac's murder was most strongly backed by the bloody gang war that broke out in Compton in the immediate aftermath of Shakur's shooting in Las Vegas. John Patash talked about this. Number one, he talked about it in the context, one, of Tupac Shakur being the godparent of Geronimo Pratt, who we just read about, was attempting, even though he was doing a lot of non-constructive things, name-calling in his music and videos and all of that, he also was doing a lot of work to try to stop gang violence between black people. Now, John Patash writes about this in detail in his book, and in fact says a part of the COINTELPRO activity was about, hey, we got this black male who is directly connected by name and biological material to Black Panthers and folks that we had to neutralize. We just finished with Geronimo Pratt. We got to hear it again, and now he's going to be putting it on a rap record? Jesus. John Patash said, hey, this it further increased their surveillance and intensified their activities towards Tupac Shakur because they did not want him to begin doing politicized rap records. Just stay with that, you know, talking about Biggie and, you know, he's a fat pig and you effed his wife and, you know, all but stick with that. That's what we want you doing. The other component of it is, John Patash also said that after the killing of Tupac Shakur, that it wasn't Suge Knight going around to get all this scurried up, that it was, this is again, COINTELPRO, and that we've seen this before, go around and agitate the niggers and get them fussing at each other and blaming each other and what, I go upside your head and ran, all the rest of it. And where these guns come mysteriously, oh my goodness, well, use them to go and get your brother. Yeah, that black guy, get him over there and do it for Pac, man, ride for Pac and kill some black people. Who would promote that sort of thinking? Usual suspects. Let's see. Says, Las Vegas police certainly had their doubts, and just about all the detectives in Vegas seemed to be sure of was that they weren't likely to arrest Shakur's killer. Las Vegas homicide guys showed us this whole cabinet of clues that they had just sort of filed away and weren't really following up on. Poole recalled, we all talked about what a defense lawyer could do with all the contradictory evidence that had come in. But then the Vegas guys told us that the main reason they would never solve this case was that the politicians didn't want them to. Now, again, I thought it was, you know, no count niggers, don't cooperate with the police, that's why we didn't solve it. No. Politics should be white people. Let's see. White people didn't want them to. They said the powers that be, white people, had let them know the city didn't need an OJ-style circus. I was shocked, but my partner was yucking it up with them and saying he feels the same way about the Smalls case, Fred said. These are just gangbangers with money. In my opinion, you could just insert nigger. That's why I said the word gang. I don't hear people talk about white people as gangbangers. They call them yahoos or white collar criminals or something. They don't call white people, I just haven't heard that. They don't call them gangbangers. They'll be anything but that. Gangbanger means nigger. Synonymous. It's the exact same thing. These are just niggers with money. Minstrel show. I got it totally. the reasoning. And I don't even know what that means. We don't want an OJ style circus. Like, do you have Las Vegas police officers who plant evidence potentially and lie on search warrants and brag about making up, you know, false crimes and allegations for black people? Do you have that in Las Vegas? Because if so, then yeah, you might have another OJ Simpson style crime. But I mean, if you have upstanding, well-behaved enforcement officials who don't lie and do their job in a professional, non-racist manner, why would this result in some sort of O.J. Simpson-style crime? Why couldn't it just be we convict the murder of Tupac Shakur and get to shine with, you know, the best of Las Vegas law enforcement? Why couldn't that be the story? No? You know how to prosecute. You know how to prosecute people in Vegas, right, O.J. Simpson? No? Oh, okay. Let's see. So then they say Suge Knight. So he says, oh, I got shot in the head and all this other stuff. So Suge Knight, they say he's not very cooperative when talking to Vegas police. They thought it was an act that he had cut himself. And he kept telling them that it was the Crips who killed Shakur, which was weird because these gangbangers never snitch on each other. Now, again, we're going back and forth. Do the niggers snitch on each other or they don't? Do they snitch on each other? I thought they just said, hey, we drop a quarter on the table and nah, 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 they tell us anything we want to know about the Crips. Do they snitch on each other or do they not? Let's see. The rumor, see, again, we got a whole book of rumor and anonymous sources. Nothing is substantial. And again, we don't even have footnotes for these conversations. Like, did you talk to this person directly? Are you reading this from something? Is this in a newspaper? Where are you getting this? Even if it's just, I want to go get more detail. Maybe I want to go read this report. Lazy, but again, I'm saying it's not lazy. I'm saying this is deliberately deceptive, concealing information. They want to push this anti-black agenda that the niggers are, as stated, the boogie monsters, and they did it all. The rumor that Knight had orchestrated the gang war that began immediately after Tupac's slaying was fueled by the report of a police informant, was it Julius Butler, who said that Suge had delivered an entire load of AK-47 assault rifles to Blood's gang members at Nickerson Gardens housing project on the night before the shooting started. At a housing project? You're telling me that a black male with a criminal record can show up at a housing project where they routinely conduct surveillance on unarmed, non-gang-banging black mothers for the slightest offense? You're telling me that Suge Knight can pull up with a U-Haul full of AK-47s and say, here, my black brothers and sisters, go out and avenge our fallen brother Tupac. And the best that we can hope for is an anonymous tip from a police informant. Are you out of your flipping mind? Are you out of your flipping mind? Maybe you've had a heat stroke. Have a seat and get some water. That makes no sense at all. I would feel really embarrassed if I believed that at any point in my life, even at 17, 12, 7. Like, are you flipping serious, Randall Sullivan? Come on, man. You got a bridge to sell me to? Who is this Suge Knight? And if you could do that, like, my God, who is this Suge Knight fella? Let's see. On the afternoon of September 13, though, Suge brought him back onto the mansion, Alexander said, and this time adopted a more threatening attitude. David Kenner was at this meeting. Uh-oh, we got a white man present. It's serious now. The bodyguards were called, and so was Death Row's head security, Reggie Wright. I think at this one, Alexander, this is Tupac's former guard, it said he thought he could have been killed at this meeting, and just super, super serious. Again, David Kenner being present, like, whoa, it has gotten serious. They said David Kenner called him up, was reading him the transcript of what he said to the police. Like, we're paying attention. We're perusing word by word. And then that right there, a white man, he's not going and threaten. He didn't go get Damu. We're going to bite somebody. They didn't say David Kenner told him, pull his pants down so I can anally rape you. David Kenner. What does Mr. Fuller say all the time? The two or the number one weapon of racist man, racist woman, racist child is words. David Kenner's an attorney, unless I'm mistaken. David Kenner, I'm sitting down with the transcript of what you said. Like, yikes. Better make sure I said the correct thing. Let's see. The police in Compton, however, continued to insist that their evidence pointed to Orlando Anderson or one of the other Crips who was in Las Vegas as Shakur's killer. Now, again, you'd have to tell me something about evidence, about Orlando Anderson. How can, and they said he did all this and then came back and is sitting in the bar chilling, not upset at all. Like, what? What? You go and kill one of the most popular entertainers in the world, and 5 minutes later, I'm chilling at the bar drinking, sipping on some Hennessy. Woo, crazy night, isn't it? Mike Tyson, Tupac, who knows? Everything happens in Vegas, huh? What? Come on, Randall Sullivan. I, again, same thing. I would hope even 17-7, Gus would be saying, come on, Randall Sullivan, you got to tell me something, man. You got a bridge you're going to sell me to? Let's see. And then we got another gangbanger. He says, Orlando Anderson, Baby Lane Anderson, was a clear cut above the average gangbanger. I just interpreted that. Live time, I read that as Baby Lane Anderson was a clear cut above the average nigger. That's exactly how I read it. That's how I'm reading the term gangbanger for the rest of the book. It means the same thing as nigger. Anything else? He would have to give me some evidence because he doesn't have any citations or anything for this alleged cozy relationship between Suge Knight and Mayor Bradley. I'm not saying it wasn't there. I'm just saying you're going to have to give evidence, man. Can't take rumors and unsubstantiated tidbits from you for an entire book. Let's see. So he talks about, he gets Officer Kenneth Knox, and they're talking about Suge Knight. He moves into this ritzy area of Los Angeles, the Tarzana Courts Homeowners Association. These gated communities in Los Angeles, like in California in general, like, yikes. Think Trayvon Martin. To think that they would allow Suge Knight and his band of ghetto gangbangers to come in there brandishing firearms and doing all this, and nothing can be done about this? If this is true as presented, I have questions about that, but if this is true as presented, like, wow, who is this Suge Knight? And does Dave Kenner, does having a white man as your friend give you that much authority? Like, wow, you can go and terrorize white Jewish neighbors, whatever that means, and nothing can be done about it? Bring in all of your armed hoodlums and dare somebody to say something about it? Yeah, I parked in your spot. And what? Thug line. Like, what? What? They can't call the in a homeowners association, you can be booted for having the wrong color on your mailbox. You got black hoodlums running amok with firearms and nothing can be done about this? Who is the Suge Knight fella? Who is David Kenner, really? Let's see. He's got a quote saying that, so they go, seeing death row, more black people doing hooligan things, despite the fact that student test scores in Compton were, oh, he tells this whole story about how they got the black people in Compton, they put all these incompetent black people in the Compton, black Compton school board. Standard operating procedure, if black people are in charge of a school, they are going to be charged with the most historic levels of incompetence, fraud, cheating. Remember all those teachers in Atlanta? They got arrested. Like, any time New Orleans, black people are in charge of the school, woo, it's going to be taken over. These are going to be the worst dumb as rocks educators in the history of life by the time it's done. Same story here. This could be true, but this is another one. We don't have any footnotes, so I just got to take Randall Sullivan's word for it, and he's already shown me a lot of anti-blackness. And again, I'd never even heard this word before. He said, feather bedding was so extreme that six secretaries did the work of one. I didn't even know what that term meant. I never even heard that before. Oh, so that means when you hire way more people than you need to do a job, it's kind of like a welfare type situation. The champion feather bedders of the known universe are all classified as white. Prison being a big one. Mark Furman! Affirmative action. We started this whole book off with that. Mark Flippin' Furman, community college dropout, GED, Mark Furman. Calm myself. It's hot in Seattle this week. Not today. Not hot at all, but calm myself. Let's see. Last few things. I already said it was black and white officers working at death row, according to John Patash. In reply to a question from Knox about why death row hired only black officers, Lewis said that the only white employees at death row records were the punk rockers he hired as his personal slaves. David Kenner, at the time, was the head of death row. Strive for accuracy. Let's see. Anything else? Suge Knight was more of a gangster, says Dr. Dre. Da, da, da. He was a legitimate music producer. Make sure I get... Oh, this is Kevin Lewis. Sorry. Kevin Lewis, wanted to work with Dre. Didn't know Suge was this major gangster, allegedly. He had been planning to leave. This is Kevin Lewis. Had been planning to leave the label since early that summer, Lewis said, but made the mistake of confiding this to a couple of other employees at the record company. The attack in the parking lot took place only a short time later, Lewis said, but being beaten with a baseball bat was a lot less frightening than the mind games Suge Knight began to play with them. Workplace racism is tomorrow on the Cow, same program time, but we talk about this all the time. Do not confide with your coworkers. These are not your homies, your friends. You don't go out drinking with them and, oh yeah, I'm leaving, I'm getting a new job, and blah, blah, blah. Unless you want everybody in the company, I don't care if you work with all black people or whatever it is, unless you're okay with everybody past, present, future who is going to work at that company knowing exactly, like they get a transcript of exactly what you said. If you're not okay with that, zip it. Oh, this will be my last comment, I think. Did I have anything else I'm going to... Yeah, this will be my last. This has happened several times in this book. I think we had a little bit of this last text, too, but particularly this book, because Randall Sullivan has so much anti-blackness. Suge also began to send around... That's just casually even referencing black... Knight. Every time. Knight. Wallace. Be a journalist. That's the way they do. You don't know these people? Be a journalist. It's not Suge. It's not Biggie Smalls. Knight. Wallace. That's the way you write it. Anyway... Suge also began to send around his crew of thugs to give them, nigger, to give them the evil eye, Lewis said. Neckbone, Heron, Chili Red, Rock, Trey, Hen Dog, Lil Wack, and the others were frightening characters, Lewis told Knox. I stopped right there. I think we had Professor Griff on the program many years back on the Cows. Public Enemy, no less. My goodness. But he said a good name is worth its weight in gold. And through this book, the last book, black people with all these names, even the names of the company, Death Row and Bad Boy and Snoop Dogg and the Dog Pound, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. Everything connected with something hideous and vile and death and criminality and drugs and childishness. Nothing in the direction of universal man, universal woman, justice, replace white supremacy with nothing in that direction at all. And even this list of names, I was just appalled. Now, Randall Sullivan could have made these names up out of thin air. But I'm just looking at the names, like, so we got Neckbone, Heron, like heroin, the drug, narcotics, Heron, Chili Red, got another non-white color, Rock, not a person, Trey, Hen Dog, alcoholic beverage, Lil Wack, no explanation needed, and others. And they're all frightening characters. Of course, they're niggers. Gangbangers, nigger, same thing. Nigger gangbanger, same thing. And again, I say Randall Sullivan could have totally made all these names up. And it's also very possible these could all be accurate names. Got them all, just didn't write the source down. That could be true. The system of white supremacy does create monsters and monstrosities. Absolutely. Could be a little bit of both, too. Any other folks' commentary they want to make sure they get in before we get ready to wrap things up? Everybody satisfied? Nothing else to add in? Assume folks are good. I did not include Sullivan, he had the exchange where he was saying Tupac Shakur, he was in prison, and so he made his response song where he's, you know, talking bad about Notorious B.I.G., and then B.I.G. Comes back with the response song to Tupac Shakur. He doesn't quote the lyrics from that song. The song that he was quoting was Unbelievable. That song was released, like, back in 94 and could have been written, like, who knows when, but I don't think that was some, oh, we're going to go back and going back and forth with Tupac Shakur and all that nonsense. Like, no, not at all. The times don't even match up. Like I said, just even that sort of thing where, oh, which song is this from? Then I can go back and see when this was recorded, how it matches up with the chronology and all that. Anywho, we'll assume folks are good. We will continue reading. We're not even at the halfway point. So more to come over the next few weeks or so. Check out City of Lies if you have free time and, you know, want to stay inside in the AC and watch a film. City of Lies if you are reading the book with us live or archive. Anywho, we'll be here tomorrow, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for everyone tuning in for the program. Hope it was worth your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best. We heard so much drug use this evening in this section of the reading today. Alcohol use and heroin, even naming folks after alcoholic beverages and narcotics and all the rest of it. We need a quality functioning brain computer, not white people's poisons. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. If we're in a vehicle, you're going out to enjoy the summer sun and all the rest of it, grand, be very alert. There have been so many incidents of violence and just random armed white thuggery. I would be very alert if you're seeing white people, if they're, you know, out in public and being hostile for any reason. Exit. This is not really a time you want to be confronting strangers. Lots of anxiety still, lots of new gun owners. You don't know if this fella is armed. You don't know if this gal or guy is armed and with an armed entourage. If you did not leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. No name calling. Man, like, you can say that like 50 times. That's one thing from this book. Retired firefighter said that some of this is based on truth. You do have a lot of name calling, gossip. And that's part of some of this nonsense where racists can really exploit that. All this gossiping and name calling and totally needless, worthless conflict with other victims of racism. Like, wow, this is a really grotesque illustration. Minimize conflict with non-white people. That is something racists thrive on and encourage. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.